Okay, we're ready to go. The Senate State and Local Government Committee will come to order. It's Wednesday, March 12, 2014. Welcome, everyone. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 2027, Senator Sharon. And I would like to ask people in the room who have e-cigarettes to please refrain from smoking them during the hearing. I can smell it. I have a very good nose. Thank you. Senator Sharon, welcome.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to present this Senate File 2027, which is a bill that deals with electronic cigarettes, in particular the treatment of the sale of those cigarettes to minors and where they can be sold, the overall arching restrictions about who can have access to the e-cigarettes. And then also in the bill is the changing of the definition. We propose in the first section, for example, of the bill that we amend the definition of smoking in the existing Clean Indoor Air Act to include e-cigarette use. Now, you might ask, why are we doing that? By making that particular change, then we can apply all of the existing law to that particular product of e-cigarettes. So, therefore, if it's enacted, wherever smoking is prohibited, e-cigarette use would also be prohibited. So that's the central component of Section 1. What's important to say about this bill, before we get going too far, is that this is nothing to do about restricting adult persons from being able to purchase, buy, utilize electronic cigarettes, even though it's a highly unregulated product, and that we really cannot assure the person what it is that they are inhaling or what they are exhaling. This bill does not address the issues of its need for regulation, although we are not opposed to that and are encouraging the FDA, as they already have been, to begin the process of creating a number of regulations about marketing practices, all those kinds of practices that FDA establishes for other products such as this. So this bill does not address those problems. This bill does not take away the right of people to purchase or make illegal this product called e-cigarettes. But what it does do is restrict the capacity of those who sell this product to sell it to minors. And although there is language related to that already, we expand the definition to make sure that all products are identified as it relates to the sale of e-cigarettes to minors. We require that it be kept behind the counter. And then in Section 1, we apply the same Clean Indoor Air Act to the smoking of e-cigarettes as we do to tobacco products that burn a tobacco product. So with that, we have other testifiers here. I guess I would add to this. You should also know then, because we've applied all of the same language now to this expanded definition of smoking, that the same processes occur that occur for tobacco smoking in indoor spaces, and the obligations to enforce that are the same for e-cigarettes as they are for tobacco products. So that all of that content from that bill just transfers over to this new definition.
Thank you, Senator Sharon, for that overview. I'm going to ask Ms. Stengel to point out the areas that are in our jurisdiction. This has already been heard by and passed by the Health and Human Services Committee. So I assume you made your case there. So we're just going to be looking at the areas that are in our jurisdiction. So I would ask the witnesses to please restrict your testimony to the areas that are under our jurisdiction. Ms. Stengel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very simply, Sections 3 and 5 are under our jurisdiction. Section 3 is the municipal license of tobacco and tobacco-related devices. And Section 5 is the effect on local ordinance, basically preemption.
I could go through those sections
Sharon,
if you would
just
like
go through
me
those
to.
Sections?
Yes. So Section 3, the purpose of Section 3 is to authorize local units of government to require retailers to obtain a tobacco retailer license in order to sell electronic delivery devices or e-cigarettes, or nicotine and lobelia delivery products other than e-cigarettes. Products that are FDA approved for use as tobacco cessation products or other medical purposes are excluded from this licensing requirement. This section also authorizes local units of government to regulate the retail sales of e-cigarettes, nicotine and lobelia delivery products. They can apply a license fee to cover enforcement costs. They can have administrative penalties for the licensees and individual salespersons, and they can develop penalties for minors and also create compliance checks. There is language that talks about the fact that the affirmative defense applies in that the person has to have known that they were selling to a minor. And then Section 5. The purpose of Section 5 is to prohibit the preemption of local ordinances that regulate in addition to sales of tobacco, the sales of tobacco-related devices. So it adds that, tobacco-related devices, e-cigarettes, and nicotine and lobelia delivery products. So it prohibits the preemption of local ordinances. They cannot withdraw from this regulation. This provision ensures that local ordinances can be more restrictive. They can do something more significant than what we have here, but not less.
Okay, we have a long agenda, so I don't want to be mean, but I might be strict about trying to keep your testimony brief and to Section 3 and Section 5 of the bill. Then, Senator Sharon, did you want to introduce the person at the table with you?
Yes, let's begin. Would you introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Molly Moylanen, and I appreciate the opportunity today to testify in support of 2027. I work for Clearway Minnesota, a nonprofit working to reduce tobacco's harm in Minnesota. I'm appearing today on the behalf of a coalition of organizations that support this legislation, including the American Cancer Society, the Heart Association, the Lung Association, the Association for Non-Smokers of Minnesota, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, Clearway Minnesota, the Minnesota Medical Association, and many others. All these organizations helped in the fight to pass the Freedom to Breathe Act back in 2007. It can be hard to remember the controversy that once surrounded the law and how it took years to pass. The reason it's so hard to remember is because today, the Freedom to Breathe Act is one of the most popular policies our state has ever seen. In fact, every survey since 2007 has found it growing more popular, with the most recent poll showing 87% approval. These days, what other state policy has approval rating like this? Now, health in Minnesota is benefiting from Freedom to Breathe. Studies have found decreases in carcinogens, heart attacks, and secondhand smoke. The public wants e-cigarettes added to the law. A new poll found 79% of Minnesotans support prohibiting e-cigarettes use in places where smoking is already prohibited. That's a huge number. An even larger number, 87%, support keeping e-cigarettes behind the counter in stores. Now, Clearway Minnesota gives grants to local organizations working with nonprofits that work with cities and counties and businesses, and we work with them to hear their concerns and get their feedback. What we're hearing from these local governments and businesses is they want direction from the state on e-cigarettes. Several communities have taken action to restrict them, but many do not have the resources to examine this question themselves and are waiting for the state to take action. On this point, too, the public is supportive. The poll that I just mentioned found that 88% feel that changing the law around e-cigarettes should happen at the state level rather than locally. The Freedom to Breathe Act was meant to protect everyone's right to breathe clean air indoors, workers, the elderly, people with compromised immune systems. Now, I'm the mother of a six-month-year-old, and when someone lights up an e-cigarette in a restaurant and starts blowing clouds of vapor around, I get very nervous because I don't know what's in it. When the law was written, e-cigarettes were only just beginning to appear in Minnesota. Its authors could not have imagined a time when they would be used to get around the law. The legislature can easily correct this loophole and show it understands the importance of the clean indoor air it protects. The public support demonstrates the proposal before you makes sense. E-cigarette use is on the rise, and people do not want them encroaching on their clean indoor air that they've enjoyed for almost 7 years. I encourage you to support this legislation. I'd also like to call your attention to a number of the handouts that were distributed, including a letter of support from the City of Minneapolis, testimony from the League of Minnesota Cities, testimony from a St. Paul student, and a few other pieces for your packets. Thank you.
Any questions?
Senator Sharon. I would call the next testifier.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we waiting till all the testifiers are done?
Unless you have a specific question for the testifier.
I do.
Okay. You want to bring Ms. Mullinan back?
Mullinan.
Okay. Right.
Moylinen, thank you.
Moylinen, thank you. Molly. thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Moylinen, I see that in League of Minnesota Cities that there is one city that prohibits e-cigarettes in a public location. Other places are actually doing it even, or at least one, prohibiting it even outside. Can you tell me, is there any scientific proof that it affects the those around the vapor? So is there secondhand vaporing going on, and is there a detriment to that?
Ms. Mullinan.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, let me just say that I agree more research is needed, but we do know from a number of studies that there have been found nicotine in the vapor as well as toxic compounds and heavy metals. So in terms of the degree of harm, I can't speak to that, but there are, I will say, the vapor that is emitted, it's not just water vapor, and we're still trying to figure out exactly what it is.
Madam Chair?
Senator Hall.
Thanks. Thus, it is affecting the person that's using it, but it's not affecting, that you know of, people around them, correct?
Ms. Mullinan.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, we don't know.
Madam Chair?
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But we do know that it is helping people stop smoking by using e-cigarettes. Is that true?
Ms. Moylinen.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, there is no body of evidence at all that shows that e-cigarettes are a proven cessation aid.
Okay.
Okay. Ms. Krug, then?
Yes. Linda Krug is from the City Council President from Duluth, Minnesota. We did try to bring testifiers that relate to the city, to the issues in front of this committee. We also have someone here from the League of Minnesota Cities who would be willing to answer specific questions about why the League of Cities is supporting statewide action.
And today is Duluth Day, so you can kill two birds with one stone. Welcome, Council President Klug.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm honored to be here. My name is Linda Krug, and I am president of the Duluth City Council, and I was a co-sponsor of the two ordinances regulating the use of e-cigarettes that the Duluth City Council passed last September. Duluth was the first city in the state to ban e-cigarettes indoors and to regulate e-cigarettes as we regulate other tobacco products. Now, it's true that in Duluth, we do like to be first, but that's not why we did this. There were other significant reasons why we wanted to regulate e-cigarettes. First and foremost, we crafted these ordinances in response to a growing number of concerns from healthcare providers, teachers, parents, health advocates, and local restaurant owners. As a group, these individuals were concerned about the easy availability of e-cigarettes at the counter, for instance, of the convenience store right next to the Snicker bars. These same people were also concerned about the growing challenge of those who wanted to vape after their meal at restaurants and the growing concern of patrons who wanted none of it. Second, we had heard rumors that a couple of businesses were thinking of adding vaping lounges, and we wanted to be proactive. We wanted to stop something from happening before it got started. And I will add that both of the businesses are doing quite well without their vaping lounges because, remember, we did not ban e-cigarettes. We simply regulated them. The third reason we passed these ordinances was because in Duluth we really do value and care about clean indoor air. As a community, we've agreed that it's important, and I'll add that this topic, this e-cigarette topic, generated more emails from our citizens than any issue that has come before us. Well, in the 6 months since Duluth passed its ordinances, we have helped other local municipalities across the state craft their ordinances. And while clearly it builds relationships, it's slow work because each city has to work within its own framework. And this is where I think you and Senate File 2027 comes in. Because what you can do better, what the state can do better than each local community is to establish a set of uniform standards. Instead of a patchwork of local ordinances, we could have a common set of rules and regulations. It seems to me that more and more communities are concerned about e-cigarettes, and we want the state to take action. So in conclusion, I just want to say that just like the League of Minnesota Cities, we do support adding electronic cigarettes to the Minnesota Clean Indoor Air Act while also preserving the ability of local government to enact more restrictive ordinances. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for President Krug? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did you want Ms. Anderson next?
Ms. Anderson could be next to speak to the issues in front of this committee. And did I mention that the League of Minnesota Cities has a representative here?
Yes, you do, and we do have their letter. Ms. Anderson, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Emily Anderson, and I'm a program director at the Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to reducing the human and economic costs of tobacco in our state. I'm here today to express my support for Senate File 2027 and to tell you about my experience working with local units of government as they struggle to address e-cigarettes. E-cigarettes, which are currently unregulated in terms of how they are manufactured, where they are used, and largely unregulated in terms of how they are sold, are understandably raising concerns among Minnesota communities. I work with them on a daily basis and hear this from them all the time. With the enactment of Freedom to Breathe in 2007, cities and counties in Minnesota no longer had to worry about adopting regulations to ensure clean indoor air. The state law set the standard we enjoy today, and the state's health department was charged with enforcement. Cities, counties, school districts, and other businesses can certainly go further, for instance, making building entrances smoke-free, but the minimum state standard for clean indoor air is clear and effective. Likewise, Minnesota's Tobacco Modernization and Compliance Act of 2010 set a clear standard for how tobacco can be sold in our state. By state law, tobacco cannot be sold to minors and must be kept behind the counter. Furthermore, tobacco vendors must be licensed, are subject to compliance checks, and are required to pay appropriate fines and fees. Again, our state has set a clear standard for local units of government to follow, while still allowing cities and counties to enforce said standard and even further regulate how tobacco is sold in their community if they so choose. This model of the state setting a standard regarding the sales and use of tobacco works. It works for reducing youth access to tobacco, and it works for ensuring clean indoor air. It also works for our local units of government, who otherwise would be burdened with the daunting task of regulating the sales and use of tobacco without any assistance or framework. As you know, the use and sale of electronic cigarettes is on the rise. Currently, the burden is solely on local governments to adjust their tobacco licensing and clean indoor air ordinances to address the issue. From my numerous conversations with city staff, decision makers, and law enforcement, it has become very clear that cities feel strongly that there is something they should be doing to regulate e-cigarettes. However, without a proper framework from the state, they often don't know how to proceed effectively. This is evidenced by the fact that our very small nonprofit alone has provided assistance to approximately 40 communities on the topic of e-cigarettes in just the past 6 months. The message we're hearing from these communities is clear. Local leaders are looking to the state to set a minimum standard that they can adopt and feel confident addresses the use and sale of e-cigarettes properly. Many communities are and will continue to opt to go further, setting more stringent regulations they feel benefit their community. But a statewide standard is necessary in order to take the burden, which equates to countless hours of staff time and precious city funds that should be used elsewhere, off cities. As the communities wait to see what they can and should be doing, we're quickly falling behind when it comes to e-cigarettes. Youth use of e-cigarettes has doubled in just 1 year, and communities are concerned about what this means for their future. The time to act is now to work on prevention. The bill in front of you is very straightforward. It contains common sense regulation, ensuring that we will all continue to breathe clean air and that we're not creating a new normal of e-cigarettes for our young people. I urge you to support the bill and to take the burden of regulating e-cigarettes off of our local governments. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Anderson, you mentioned something about law enforcement. Is there any letters or anything that I see a lot of law enforcement here? I'm just wondering if there's a letter from law enforcement that said that this is a big burden on their being able to, are they having problems with individuals that have e-cigarettes and stuff? I'd like to get some feedback from whether local sheriffs or local police people are having problems with that.
Senator Sharon,
may I suggest that the League of Minnesota Cities come? The law enforcement agents that are responsible for this are employees of the cities, and I think that they would be best able to respond with authority to your questions.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Anderson mentioned law enforcement, so I figured in her testimony she must have some kind of evidence that demonstrates that there's a problem with law enforcement dealing that. So I'd just like a response.
Mm-hmm. She's suggesting that. Oh, Ms. Anderson, go ahead.
Chair Pappas, Senator Anderson, I can recap my personal conversations with law enforcement. I talked to a police chief this morning and a few other officers who are responsible for compliance checks, and they talk about how they would like a better standard set at the state level so that they can ensure that they're enacting those compliance checks properly and that they are, in fact, seeing that increased youth use at their local level. We have that national data, but that just anecdotally is what I will speak to, and I will defer to the League of Minnesota representative for something more concrete. But from my personal experience, law enforcement are seeing on the ground level what we're seeing in the data.
Ms. Lindstrom, did you have more information from the law enforcement in your cities?
Thank you, Chair Pappas. I'm Ann Lindstrom for the League of Minnesota Cities. I would just echo what you have to say about it, is that there's not a lot of concrete data on what's happening with law enforcement, but they're struggling in the regulation aspect, particularly because it's such a patchwork from city to city and not knowing what the regulations are.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Anderson, your background is pretty much with tobacco products, correct?
Ms. Anderson.
Chair Pappas, Senator Hall, correct.
Ms. Anderson, would you say that e-cigarettes are as bad as tobacco products?
Ms. Anderson.
Senator Pappas, Chair Hall, I would ask for clarification on as bad as tobacco cigarettes.
They are, you say?
I'm asking for a clarification, if you could clarify your question.
Well, for someone's health, if someone's smoking a tobacco cigarette versus an e-cigarette, is it just as bad or is it a better product health-wise?
Sanderson.
Chair Pappas, Senator Hall, I'll refer to what Ms. Moylan said in her testimony, that there is certainly a wealth of data that we still need to gather on these products. I think from a tobacco prevention, my background in tobacco prevention, we've set a clear standard for clean indoor air in our community, and that standard is not set at secondhand tobacco smoke. It's set at clean indoor air, and these products may fall somewhere in between there, but they certainly have an impact on the clean indoor air of the standard that we've set for the past 7 years in our state.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
And Ms. Anderson, tell me what part of e-cigarettes affects the clean air.
Senator Hall, we'll continue a little bit with this line of questioning, okay. But remember, we're trying to restrict it to the local government's relationship here with the e-cigarettes, just because the health committee has already determined that there's a health impact. But I'll, you know, if you want to get an answer to that last question, and then could we move on then?
Sure.
Okay, so we want to repeat that question?
Sure. Well, what part of the clean air in a e-cigarette is unhealthy?
Ms. Anderson.
Chair Pappas, Senator Hall, I will defer to our Commissioner of Health, who's here. Dr. Ed Ellinger is, like I said, the Commissioner of Health in Minnesota, as well as a physician. I would like to defer that question to him, if possible.
I'd rather not. I'd rather hear from her.
And I'd like to defer the question, period.
Okay.
So,
Senator Pappas, Senator Sharon. I'm hoping that you agree to hear from an expert, you know, if we really want to hear the answer to the question, if you want to give us some space to answer questions about those things again, I think that we should get it from the proper source.
Okay. Let's. Do you have any more testifiers?
I do not have any more testifiers.
I'll just go to the list then. That's Mr. O'Rourke. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, my name is Cap O'Rourke, and I am representing the Independent Vaping Retailers of Minnesota. My clients are Association of Retailers, Manufacturers, and Distributors, all based in Minnesota. We are not tobacco companies. We do not produce any tobacco products. My clients, while we do not support Senafile 27 due to the current limitations on public use, despite any scientific-backed evidence that there's harm to bystanders, and there have been no studies to address Senator Hall's point that show harmful levels of any of the chemicals or metals emitted from e-cigarettes. There are trace amounts of these, but there's not been a study that shows harmful levels of these products.
Mr. O'Rourke, our jurisdiction really has to do with local government, whether we should help local government regulate these products. The Health Committee has already determined they should be regulated.
Madam Chair, and I am focusing on that. I am answering
Great.
To some of the
it's
previous
It's okay to have some introductory comments, but I want to make sure
just an introductory
you're going
comment,
in that
and I'm trying to focus on the local government issue.
Thank you. Did I forget to call on you before?
I was just going to say, Madam Chair, I, for one, am not a member who votes on bills in a sort of isolated fashion. I vote on the merits of the whole bill every time. And so, Mike, I would hope that we can just have a discussion about the merits of the bill instead of continuing to sort of interrupt the conversation, which I'm not sure saves any time in the first place.
Well, Senator Peterson, I certainly want to be respectful to the members of the committee and to allow some background comments. Senator Sharon gave her background comments. Certainly, Mr. O'Rourke could give some background comments. I just don't want us to spend a lot of time on that. Unfortunately, you weren't you're not, this is your only committee that you can hear this bill, and you're not on commerce or health.
No, my point is just, Madam Chair, that I will cast a vote on this bill like I cast a vote on every bill,
right.
And whether it's merited or it's not. And that includes all of the issues surrounding the bill.
I understand.
Not just the jurisdiction of this committee.
And you have that opportunity during floor debate to decide how you
want
to vote, too.
Thanks.
Mr. O'Rourke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My members share the goal of Senator Sharon in preventing the sale of e-cigarettes or vaping solutions and products to anyone under the age of 18. Our retail shops have a policy of carding anyone under the age of 30. In fact, one of our retail shops recently passed a local compliance check. We also support the clarification of local licensing, as there are a number of cities in which there is ample amount of confusion about what is required for businesses selling vaping products. We agree that more clarification is required to ensure that there are common requirements for these businesses to operate within Minnesota. Some of my shop owners who have multiple shops in differing municipalities have expressed the concern about the requirements in one city and the complete lack of requirements in another city. And so they actually support kind of the clarification of what local cities are supposed to do. With regards to the comments made about eliminating the patchwork around the state, it's very ironic that in one breath people will say we need to pass this law to eliminate the patchwork, and in the very next breath they ask for the ability to further create that patchwork system throughout the state. If you're going to create a system throughout the state so everything's on a level field, that's one thing. But if you're going to set a baseline and then have the local municipalities enact ordinances that further create that patchwork, well, the patchwork argument is no longer valid. We currently, if you pass this bill, we'll still have a patchwork of municipality regulations throughout the state. In some cities, such as in Duluth, you cannot sample a vaping product within the vape shop. In other cities, you will be able to. In some cities, you will not be able to. Some cities, you'll be able to use this out near a door. In other cities, you may not. So we'll still have the patchwork. And for small business people that are looking to expand, it's a growing business. Having a consistent frame of regulations would be appreciated. So we're not opposed to some of the regulations, but we can't argue against having a patchwork and then also ask to enhance that patchwork throughout the state. We will continue to work with the center and we as long as we can to try to create regulations that both work for the municipalities but also make sure it's not overly limiting on the businesses that are trying to operate in Minnesota.
Okay, questions for Mr. O'Rourke. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. O'Rourke, to your knowledge, are there any of your entities or any entities in general that sell e-cigarette products to people under the age of 18?
Mr. O'Rourke.
Of course. It is the standard practice of all of my clients who are retail shops. Some of our organization are both manufacturers and distributors, so they don't actually do retail sales. All of the shops that are retail have a policy of not selling to anyone under the age or carding people under the age of 30 and not selling to anyone under the age of 18. I think all of my shops that are retail don't allow anyone under the age of 18 even into the shop unless they're accompanied by a parent or a guardian. And they do not sell products that don't contain nicotine to someone under the age of 18.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. O'Rourke, thanks for coming over. I have a question about the marketing aspect of it, which may not be your retailers don't make them. They just sell whatever products that they have. I've seen some of the products that look like they're marketing to young people, things like Hello Kitty vapors or Batman or whatever it is. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like? Because I think that helps us understand this issue of if kids are being marketed to regardless to what has actually happened at the point of sale.
If you give me one sec, Madam Chair, if I can grab a bag that's at my chair over there, I'll show you some of the items.
And Senator Hayden, since you just came in the room, we are allowing some general questions, but in general, we want to stick to our jurisdiction.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. A little mixed up.
Everybody's had their little general question.
Senator Hayden, I have seen and heard the Hello Kitty argument and seen those as well. In dealing with my shops, and there are a lot of places that sell e-cigarette products that are not in part of my organization. But when the first Hello Kitty one came out, most of my shops were very surprised at what that was or where someone bought it. They don't sell, most of the shops that I work with, this is pretty much what you will see inside their shop. These two items, this would be considered kind of a beginner starting up. You have kind of the ones that look like what they call cigalikes, and these look like cigarettes. Most of my shops don't actually sell these. We pretty much deal with these larger items. So as far as the marketing, most of that is probably done by the larger national corporations. Sometimes those are the tobacco companies, and my clients are not. It's an odd allegiance and somewhat uncomfortable one for a lot of my clients, actually, because they do not sell tobacco products, and they do not agree with a lot of the marketing that has been done. In some of the other committees, there's been a picture of a woman who is in her senior years giving the finger to, I don't know who she's giving the finger to, but it's expressed as a loophole around the smoking ordinances. And a lot of my shop owners have expressed dismay about that kind of advertising campaign. And so a lot of the marketing that's been done is done by big corporations that have money to do marketing. My businesses are small businesses that are taking out little ads in their weekly newspapers and not doing coercive marketing towards kids.
Any more questions for Mr. O'Rourke? Okay, thank you. Then we'll move on to Ryan Abbott. Is he not here? Oh, okay. I'm just kind of waiting. Then Jesse Ray. All right. That's fine. Mr. Ray, if you could just repeat your name for the tape, please.
Absolutely. Good afternoon. My name is Jesse Ray, and I am a lifelong resident of the state of Minnesota. I'm also very passionate about the use of electronic cigarettes as a reduced harm alternative to traditional combustible tobacco. Anecdotally, in middle school, I was a DARE essay winner. Fast forward a few years later, and I tried my first cigarette at the age of 16. By the time I went to Gustavus Adolphus College, I was smoking nearly a pack a day. After 10 years of traditional tobacco use, I found electronic cigarettes. Prior to trying an electronic cigarette for the first time, I had on multiple occasions tried to quit using various methods, the patch, the gum, cold turkey, even supplanting or trying to switch my tobacco use to chewing tobacco. Of course, none of those things worked for me, but the electronic cigarette did. And I'm proud to say I haven't had a cigarette of the traditional combustible tobacco variety since April of 2010, so coming up on nearly 4 years. Since then, I have taken to running a YouTube channel, which currently has over 3,800 subscribers. I've hosted countless hours of live webcasts across several online networks devoted to the safe use of electronic cigarettes for adults. I'm part of the Legal Watch Committee for CASA, the Consumer Advocates for Smoke-Free Alternatives. And I recently began serving in a consumer advocate role for AMSA, the American E-Liquid Manufacturing Standards Association. If you're not familiar with AMSA, it is a trade union that currently has over 25 e-liquid manufacturers who banded together to ensure e-liquid ingredients come from verifiable sources, are mixed in professional environments meeting food and lab standards, and safe shipping practices are also followed. As an all-volunteer organization with a 501c6 designation, AMSA consults with multiple PhD-level chemists, as well as world-renowned cardiologist Dr. Konstantinos Varsalinos from Greece, who is widely considered one of the most foremost medical experts in the field of electronic cigarettes. As an advocate of electronic cigarette use, I have no problem with ensuring that electronic cigarettes are not obtained or used by those under the age of 18. Being opposed to allowing minors access to nicotine delivery devices would be a fairly foolish position for anyone to take. However, there are some things that I would like to present today, much of those which focus on the demonization of electronic cigarettes and how that may relate to our youth as well as our clean air. Again, I am in complete support of ensuring that those under the legal age to purchase tobacco products do not have access to electronic cigarettes, nor should they be allowed for use in public places such as schools. We could talk at length about flavoring and marketing, but nothing in this legislation does anything to address those topics. If it did, we could be here for hours talking about the new Fruit Chill Nicorette or potentially Smirnoff Raspberry Pomegranate Sorbet Vodka, which is readily available. Electronic cigarettes are commonly touted as a gateway to smoking for our youth, despite any measurable evidence as such. A recent study based on national data, which was written by Dr. Stan Glantz and Lauren Dutra, claims that, and I quote, "It looks to me like the Wild West marketing of e-cigarettes is not only encouraging youth to smoke them, but it is also promoting regular cigarette smoking among youth." Again, I quote, "E-cigarettes are likely to be gateway devices for nicotine addiction among youth, opening up a whole new market for tobacco." I would consider these statements to be quite deceitful, and they undermine the author's own assertions that, according to their report, I quote, "This is a cross-sectional study which only allows us to identify associations, not casual relationships." And two, "This cross-sectional nature of our study does not allow us to identify whether most youth are initiating smoking with conventional cigarettes and then moving on to, usually dual use of, e-cigarettes or vice versa." Right there, the own author undermines their own statement that, you know, children are using this as a gateway to traditional tobacco, one of the major arguments for restriction of electronic cigarettes in public youth. It's important to note that domestic sales for both Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds have declined about 4.1 and 4.6 respectively over the last year, and youth smoking rates remain at approximately 14%. They've not really risen despite the use of electronic cigarettes having risen to roughly 7%. If electronic cigarettes are really driving youth to seek traditional tobacco cigarettes, there should be some sort of notable uptick or even a causal-related correlation with them amongst minors. The data does not support these claims that are being aimed at electronic cigarettes. Again, it is important to note that I am opposed to selling nicotine delivery products of any kind to minors, but if we want to discuss the children and how they fit into this, perhaps a better use of our time is finding a way to ensure that we're feeding the kids who can't afford school lunch rather than worrying about their electronic cigarette use. During the House Health and Human Services hearing regarding HF 1931, where it was voted and Section 1 was removed from the proposal, Representative Zerwas asked Minnesota's Dr. Ellinger, who is here, the Commissioner of the Department of Health, how many studies link e-cigarettes to children beginning to smoke? And in his own words, I quote, there are no studies that show the transfer of children to tobacco use. Another commonly accepted belief that we've heard in these hearings is that e-liquid contains and emits harmful chemicals. Sometimes the 2009 FDA study is often cited due to their report of finding trace amounts of diethylene glycol in a single sample. The findings of this study have never been duplicated, even from similar tests, calling into question the validity of the sample obtained. Diethylene glycol itself is found in many common objects, such as toothpaste, mouthwash, and cough syrup, but we're not here to discuss those today. Diethylene glycol has 1/10 the toxicity of aspirin and 1/40 the toxicity of nicotine itself, hardly a cause for great concern. Another claim, and we've heard it here again today, is the presence of heavy metals in electronic cigarette liquids and or vapor. Upon analysis, there are several immediate concerns with some of the studies that have been done. The often-cited University of California Riverside study consisted of dissecting cartomizers, which are made of metal, so it is entirely possible that metal shavings were left behind due to the dissection. Many of the cartomizers they tested were claimed to be new, but from the images included in the report, it's very clear that they were used prior to being used for the study.
Mr. Ray, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but our committee is only looking at Section 3 and Section 5 of the bill,
Certainly.
Which is the regulation by local government.
Certainly.
So if you could wrap up your comments, you've gone on for quite a while, and it's been very interesting, but we're trying to be a little more focused here.
Well, let me close then in saying that this is going to be a very difficult law to enforce, simply because it's going to be very difficult to tell if someone is using an electronic cigarette. For all you know, someone could have been using. I'm not saying that I was not, but someone could have been using one in this room. If someone using an electronic cigarette simply holds their breath for a few seconds, their lungs will absorb any trace water vapor that they would exhale, making it very difficult to determine if someone is doing anything different than sucking on a pen or drinking a soft drink. It's going to be problematic because I could walk into a bathroom, use an e-cigarette for an hour, 2 hours, however long I felt the need to be there, and you would never know, aside from maybe coming in and it smelling better than your average public restroom.
Senator Thompson.
Actually, I'll just pull off. Yeah.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I hope you'll indulge me. It'll be a straightforward question. I don't think it'd take long to answer. Why do you limit under 18-year-old children from buying e-cigarettes if they're not harmful?
Mr. Ray.
I've never claimed that they're not harmful. They are a reduced harm alternative. Certainly there are concerns about nicotine intake. Societally, we've decided that nicotine needs to be regulated to people at least of 18 years of age. Just like we've decided that in order to vote, you need to be 18. In order to purchase alcohol, you need to be 21.
Is there any? Thank you very much, Mr. Ray. Any final comments, Senator Sharon?
Yes, thank you. I really did not open with any discussion to really refute a number of the things that were said here, which creates a problem, I think, for some of the members.
So I'll give you that opportunity.
I just would like you to know that that there is evidence that toxic exposures to e-cigarettes exists. The Minnesota Department of Health just recently came out with evidence of the increase in the numbers of reported toxic poisoning with nicotine. And of those, let me just show you, there were 5 in 2011. It's up in 213. There's 53 reports. And what was really striking out, that doesn't mean it's from, it doesn't necessarily mean it's from the inhalation of the vapor. I want to be clear about that. But to discuss this as though there's not, when you're using nicotine and acting as though the seventh most toxic substance is not potentially harmful, and in a device where we have not regulated, actually the purchaser can determine how much nicotine they want in their capsules. So I just didn't want to go over there and get into a struggle about that, because this bill doesn't restrict the right of people to purchase this product. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't restrict their ability to design what it is they want to put in their liquids. It simply is saying that the public, based on the polling and based on the fact that we don't have solid evidence that it is not harmful as well as that it is harmful, that the public doesn't want to take the risk with the person who uses an e-cigarette in public places. They're simply supportive of the anecdotal stories of those who have found this is a cessation method. We're very supportive that that happens. We know that we don't have the data to support that that is a valid tool like Nicorette is or the patches are. We have the data to support that, but not here. But I accept that some people may find this as an alternative way to reduce smoking. Nothing about this bill stops that or prohibits that or discourages that. This bill is about asking that you not ask the public to take the risk with them in such an unregulated area. And since alternatives are in place for people to use in enclosed places that would feed the nicotine, that it's not unreasonable until we are more confident about safety issues that those who want to buy this product continue to buy and continue to use it as adults, but not to ask the public to take the risk with them.
Senator Peterson, and then Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you've stated, Senator Sharon, and even your own testifiers have stated that there's absolutely no evidence to show that secondhand use of e-cigarettes is harmful in any way. In light of that fact, isn't the burden of restricting sort of free activity of free individuals on the government to show harm before restricting that activity?
I think that's
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. I think that's a fair question. I didn't finish reading here from the toxic exposures, but I'd just like to share with you because I know that data is important to the members of the committee. Of the 74 phone calls that were made in 2013, this is on toxic levels, toxic exposures, 50 were for children under the age of 20. 29 calls about children who were 2 years age and younger. So that indicates to me that unless we're pouring liquid down the throats of young adults, two-year-olds, or blowing vapor directly at them, how do you explain 2 years and under? So that, and the second point that you're making about this is why would the government be engaged in interfering with a practice if the evidence isn't in place? And that I think, in part, gets to the heart of what people will be struggling with about this debate. And there is precedence for us as government, especially when it relates to toxic substances or chemicals, to ask businesses, pharmaceutical companies in particular, to engage in significant research before they sell a product to the general public until we know for certain because of that research that its claims for what it does are valid, and that they've been tested, and that the outcome of the drug does what it says it does, or in this case, that it does create a cessation of smoking, that it not be sold to the general public. That would be an example of that there are times the government does and times the government doesn't engage in restrictions based on what it does or does not know. What we do know is that we do not know the level of risk, and we do know that the public is asking us to not ask them to share this risk with those who are using e-cigarettes. And we do know that in this bill, we don't ask those who want to use this to give it up or not be able to purchase it if they're adults, but to simply restrict that use in the places where we restrict smoking.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Sharon. So we know that we do not know if there's risk. I think that's important to point out. Members,
May I modify that? We know that we do not know the level of risk.
According to your own testifiers, according to yourself, there's no evidence to show there's harm for secondhand use. But I'll spare the series of questions to you and just say this. The idea that the government would step in this case and regulate on with no grounds of harm to anybody should be a cause for concern of every member of this committee and every person in this room, regardless of what you feel about the merits of personal e-cigarette use. At some point, there has to be a basis for regulation. This is blind regulation. There is no scientific basis for this interaction. And anybody who values sort of any basic common notion of freedom really should reject this bill on that basis alone. And it's a lot more fundamental than e-cigarettes or anything else. The idea, I mean, it's irresponsible to put forward legislation that has no rational scientific basis and impede upon the free activities of people on that basis alone. I cannot believe it, Madam Chair, and I'd ask for a roll call on the bill.
Roll call's been requested. Senator Sharon.
May I just state that I do know that there are those that, as been stated, would let anybody do whatever they wanted to do until we were absolutely certain that what was happening was harmful. The government has, and the public does have an interest in being protected from the harm, and to not ask the public to take a risk on a product that has in it a substance that is toxic, and in a product that has a capsule in it that can contain a variety of substances, none of which we know whether or not it's being vaped into the general public air or not, and that the failure for us to have assurances because we don't have the regulation, we don't know what's in there, to ask the general public to take a risk on that, I think would be the irresponsible action.
I feel like I have to speak, Senator Peterson and members. It's really, there's actually a word for this called the precautionary principle. And I think if you look through the last decades, that the public was sold a bill of goods in many circumstances, including cigarettes, and about a lot of toxic chemicals, that these are safe, you know, better living with, what was that expression?
Better living with general.
Thank you. And that we'd find out decades later that, no, these chemicals are toxic, and that's why we have cancer and why we have lung disease and why we have all these other problems in our society. But it took decades to prove that to actually prove, and even then you can't 100% prove in science many times, that these really were causing the cancers or the whatever the toxicity was. So I think that there's a reason why people have gotten more cautious when new products come on the market and, like pharmaceuticals, want to have some testing done to prove that they're safe before we use them, rather than your perspective, which is to allow them until they're proven to be unsafe, because that can take decades. Senator Peterson.
I'll be really brief, Madam Chair, and the only reason I'm responding is because now I've been addressed twice by members in the room. If there's no basis, no scientific basis, no basis whatsoever for acting in this case, then there really is an unlimited ability for us to regulate anything with preemption. The burden is always on government to prove harm or risk of harm before acting, or at least it should be.
I think
if there isn't, then there's no limitation.
No, I think the burden is on the industry to prove there's no harm before we legalize it.
We respectfully disagree, Madam Chair.
We may want to continue this debate.
I just want to expand upon what Senator Peterson said. There are two views of the role of government. One is that ultimately the individual should have free choice and free will and the ability to conduct themselves in the way that they want to until it is demonstrated reasonably that they are harming others. The other view is that the government is there to be our parent and to govern our conduct and dictate our behavior and infringe upon people's rights. I mean, the notion, and I'm trying to quote you correctly, Madam Chair, that it should be the burden of the purveyors of products to prove their safety before the government should allow them to be legal. Think through the implications of that. Every food product that comes out, everything, I mean, why wouldn't we take the next food product that comes out that has substances in it that we deem to be unsafe and just say, You can't manufacture that. I mean,
already are laws in place that govern that. Pharmaceuticals is a great example. That there are already regulations on toxic chemicals that you have to prove that they're safe before they can be used in products.
But nobody's even demonstrated, Madam Chair, with all due respect, that there are toxic chemicals in this thing that are a danger to anybody.
Nicotine is a toxic chemical. You know, I mean, we're not, people are going to choose to smoke these products. The argument is, should other people have to be exposed to them if they don't want to smoke this product?
All right.
That's the basic premise.
Very enlightening discussion, shall we say.
Air Act. All right. Do we have a motion?
Well, I can't make the motion, but I would conclude by saying, that there's a disagreement, fundamental to, on the front end or on the back end, do we establish a boundary with toxic chemicals? And that's a narrow conversation about toxic chemicals. And I think that it would be... I think there's always a fear the government will become over paternalistic or intrusive in all matters if we do this one action. I think that is a terribly grandiose generalization about all people wanting to regulate absolutely everything if you want to reduce the risk to the general public for exposure to vaping.
Briefly, Senator Thompson, then we're going
to briefly.
Vote.
Exhibit 1. To the degree to which this can go to the absurd, they are regulating the size of beverages that can be sold in New York. People, to those who have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Senator Hall, I didn't call on you. Did you have something?
No, I'm fine.
Senator Torres-Ray, move it.
I would like to move the bill.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Senator Torres-Ray then moves that Senate File 2027 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Commerce. Right. The clerk will take the roll.
Pappas?
Yes.
Eaton?
Yes.
Hall?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Dahl?
Yes.
Hayden?
Aye.
Housley?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Scalzi?
Yes.
Thompson?
No.
Torres Ray?
Yes.
Wickland?
Yes.
8-5. On an 8-5 vote, the motion does prevail, so the bill is going to be sent to the Commerce Committee. Thank you, Senator Sharon. Thank you, members. So it's a very interesting discussion. The next bill, Senator Eaton's bill, 2415.
I'm not a TV watcher, so I miss a lot of them.
Yeah.
It's regular tobacco.
There are some.
I know. We used to do that when our kids were little.
Yes.
We have them, I think.
I small.
Want a copy?
Oh, you did. Never. You were smart.
Senator Eaton?
Oh, there you are. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was having trouble locating the chair.
Sure, you may proceed. Go ahead.
Thank you. The handouts that were handed out have the wrong Senate file number on them, but they are about 2415. This is the State Employees with Disabilities Central Accommodation Fund Feasibility Study and Legislative Report Requirements. So this will help address a problem that state government has, the underrepresentation of people with disabilities in our workforce. In 1999, 10% of the state workforce had a disability. Today, only 3.2% of the state workforce has a disability. This study would examine what the federal government, the states of Utah, Massachusetts, and Washington state have done in creating a centralized accommodation fund. The funds have been shown to save money by centralizing the administrative costs, give more buying power, therefore therefore reducing the overall cost of state government, and help hiring managers focus on the skills of people with disabilities, therefore or thereby reducing the risk of an unintentional or intentional discrimination based on accommodations. With me today is Jesselyn Ackerman Frank of the Commission on Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans.
Thank you, Senator Eaton. I see you have amendment. Do you want to move that amendment now as an
Yes, please.
Amendment?
It's a technical amendment.
Do you want to explain it at all?
The A1 amendment corrects some language, and I would ask counsel to explain why they had me do it.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton, and members, this makes two changes, really. One, the original bill on line 1.7 provided for a report to the legislature. This just clarifies that that report is to the chairs and ranking minority members in both the Senate and the House of the committees with primary jurisdiction over state employment. And then on lines 1.8 into 1.9, the original bill calls for creating a central fund in the state treasury, and the amendment provides instead for it to create a dedicated account in the special revenue fund. I should clarify, this bill doesn't create the fund. It provides for studying the use of the fund, but the amendment properly describes what the fund would be.
On the A1 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Eaton, did you have some testifiers?
Yes. Need to introduce yourself.
Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, this is Jesselyn Ackerman Frank. And thank you very much for having me here today. I am here to testify. I am the Public Policy Director for the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing. We are a small state agency that advocates for equal opportunity in employment, education, healthcare, technology, and public services. I want to thank Senator Eaton for sponsoring this important bill. You see on the chart before you the stark numbers. We have gone from 10.1% in 1999 all the way down to 3.2% in 2013. The state isn't hiring many people with disabilities, and we want to change that. To help ensure that businesses and the state find the highly skilled workers they need, we must expand work opportunities for the 1 in 6 Minnesotans that have a disability and get rid of barriers to employment. The Governor's Workforce Development Council created All Hands on Deck, a blueprint for strengthening Minnesota's workforce and closing the state skills gap, was approved by the Governor Dayton in 2012. It makes specific recommendations on how the state can become a model employer for people with disabilities. Included in those recommendations is creating a centralized accommodations fund. We have also included a report from Massachusetts on their centralized fund and a request form for accommodations from the Veterans Administration. The federal government has a centralized fund. This fund would benefit all people with disabilities. To provide more information on why this is important, I would like to introduce Alan Parnes, one of our commission members.
Mr. Parnes, welcome.
I am Alan Parnes, a member of the Commission for Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am here to talk in support of the proposed legislation for the Centralized Accommodation Fund Feasibility Study. This proposed legislation is a small but important step towards further reducing communication barriers in the workplace that affect deaf and hard of hearing people. This particular step focuses on deaf and hard of hearing employees of state government. It is hoped that this effort will eventually create a model for other types of government and private employers to emulate. I retired in 2010 after 41 years as a vocational rehabilitation counselor for deaf and hard of hearing. 22 of those years were here in Minnesota. I have worked in Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan. One of the things I've observed over the years was the effect of cost dissonance that employers face when deciding whether cost disincentives, that was the interpreter's mistake, that employers face when deciding whether to provide communication-related accommodations for their deaf and hard-of-hearing employees. Communication for deaf people is cost-driven. Unlike people with physical barriers requiring one-time upfront costs, communication barriers are permanent ongoing costs. This results in a cost disincentive. Quite understandably, employers need to take into consideration the cost of providing communication access services, such as sign language interpreters and real-time captioning. Supervisors have to live within their individual department budgets, and this often determines whether deaf and hard of hearing employees get sufficient communication access needed to do their jobs. The cost disincentive also greatly influences hiring decisions when it comes to deaf and hard of hearing job applicants. People often ask me, but what about the American with Disabilities Act? That law, from my observation, over the years has limited applicability in day-to-day work situations. I'm sorry, I'm a little lost. Most deaf employees are afraid to file reports against their employers to the proper authorities for fear of losing their jobs. The very tough job market we have had during the past 5 years has created a much higher employment barrier for deaf and hard of hearing people. Employers are often easily able to avoid hiring deaf and hard of hearing people because of having so many highly qualified applicants available. It is extremely difficult to prove they discriminate against deaf and hard of hearing applicants. In many cases with existing deaf and hard of hearing employees, it may not always be the case of discrimination per se, but one of being practical when faced with severe budget limitations. This can equally be as true in state government as in the private sector. Thus, the proposed legislation to study the advantages of creating a central accommodations fund could lead to improved communication access for deaf and hard of hearing state employees, and the eventual fund could become a model for private employers in our state. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify before this committee today.
Are there any questions for either of the witnesses? Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, looking at the amendment that was put on and the words that were deleted, I see in the heading of the bill it says creating a central fund, and I thought we just deleted that in the body of the bill. I'm just wondering if that should be deleted in the heading of the bill itself.
Do we have to do a motion now? You just amend the title appropriately.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, that's a good catch. It can be fixed informally on its way. It's a direction we'll give to the engrossing office to amend the title.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
is this in line 1.13 and line 1.16? Is this supposed to be called a central accommodation fund? Is that what this new name is, or is this going to be just the use of an accommodation fund? We're using central. It was deleted once. I'm curious as to why we're using it again and again, or is that going to be the new name for this fund instead of a dedicated account in a special revenue fund?
Madam Chair. Line 1.5. Senator Eaton.
The point of the bill is to have a central account for all state government employers to get funding to help with people with a disability, you know, the expenses of accommodating that. And so I think that as I don't know that that's the technical name of the fund, or rather that we want a central fund, if you know what I'm saying.
Right. Well, I think that if you have a purpose of a dedicated account in special revenue, because it does look to me like on line 113, we're using that word central accommodation fund again on 113.
And 116, Madam Chair.
Ms. Hartman.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett. I'm with the commission too. Centralized accommodation fund is the term that's used commonly within federal government. It's used within many other sectors, but we'll conform with that, or whatever makes it clear. We just want to make it clear that it's a dedicated fund for accommodations that will remove those barriers, and we're happy to conform with whatever, you know, it makes it clear and makes the revenue.
So we could continue to call it a central accommodation fund just on those lines where we made the change. We were creating a dedicated fund in the state treasury. Mm-hmm. So Ms. James maybe can tell us, do we need to be consistent and call it a dedicated fund every place, or can we stay with central accommodation fund?
Madam Chair and members, the change that we made on lines 1.8 and 1.9 help explain what sort of a fund it is. It's fine if we want to give it a name, this dedicated account, but we should call it an account rather than a fund when we name it. So maybe I can work on making that consistent throughout offline.
Okay.
And come back to that.
You could also do it in Finance Committee, because this does have to go to Finance Committee.
Yes,
so
Madam Chair.
Why don't we leave it the way it is, and then they'll figure out the correct names to call everything in Finance Committee. Is that okay, Senator Anderson?
You're the chair.
We just have a long agenda.
Madam Chair.
All right, Senator Eaton.
I would just ask for the committee to support this. It's a study. Our understanding, there would be no cost, but the House has asked for a fiscal statement, and we haven't got the results yet, so we're moving it to Finance just in case.
All right. You want to make the motion?
I move that this bill be passed and sent to Finance.
Senate moves that Senate File 2415 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Metzen, 2110. We're going to take you next, and then we'll do Senator Dietzen. He said he'd be fast. He's been sitting here for a while.
Would you guys sign in, please?
I've got a good bill.
Thank you,
really the ones to figure out what it should be. Senator Metzen, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 2110 is an exemption from the of threaders from the cosmetology licensing requirement. Threading is a method of removing hair from the eyebrows, upper lips, or other body parts. The Minnesota Board of Cosmetology has met a number of times on this request, and they unanimously support this bill that codifies the exemption of the threaders. Threading is safe, simple, relatively painless, and it does not create any health or safety risks. And again, the Cosmetology Board has unanimously, they've talked about it a couple times, and they say that it doesn't have to be under their jurisdiction or watch.
Okay, should we hear briefly from your witnesses?
Yeah, very briefly. We have the owner of five of these shops in Minnesota.
Please introduce yourself for the tape and the members.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Tanvir Nasiruddin. I'd like to first off thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of this bill. I am currently the owner of five locations here in Minnesota, and just wanted to reiterate the fact that threading is it's a very natural, safe, effective method of hair removal, and would be happy to answer any questions you have on the technique and the art. And thank you once again.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Metzen, have you ever gone under a threading procedure? Do you personally know about
that? Absolutely, all the time.
Senator Metzen.
The threading I've ever had was when I was a goalie in South St. Paul and at the University of Minnesota, and they thread me up here about 12 stitches and here about five. So that's my experience,
okay.
Senator,
with
threading.
Thank you,
Sign, yeah.
Did you want a couple more words?
Mr. McGrath, welcome.
Madam Chairman, thank you. Members of the committee, I'm Lee McGrath. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota chapter of the Institute for Justice. I just want to thank Senator Metzen as well as the Cosmetology Board for their support of this bill, and I stand ready to answer any questions about the bill.
Does it hurt?
Relatively, just a little bit.
A little bit. It's relatively relatively painless. Yes.
Relatively.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Does anyone else want to testify?
That's it.
Do we have a motion from the committee? Do we have a co-author here? Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 2110 be recommended to pass. Goes to the floor.
Thank you very much.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Dietzick,
one
thank
of my
you.
Re-election bills here.
Yeah, I think so. Does he have a shop in your district, Senator?
No, it doesn't. I think he would get this bill to me somehow. I think he did. We'll do that.
Hayden should have had the bill.
Senator Dietzick, welcome.
Yeah, going here too much. Yeah, I go there every week.
Little did we know you were being threatened.
She missed her witnesses missing.
Oh my!
Does it stay there forever?
Okay. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. Senate File 1770 clarifies application of the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act for parties contracting with government entities. The Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, I have an acronym, states that when a private firm contracts with government entity, any data created, collected, received, stored, used, or disseminated under the contract is subject to the Government Data Practices Act. The legislator created the act in 1974 to help balance an individual's right to privacy and the public's right to monitor activity. Many believed the act applied even if a government contract did not specifically contain a notice or contain a notice stating the act applied. Last year, a case discussing the act, if the act applies, went all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled that the act should contain express language and impose direct obligations if that was the intent of the legislature. This bill clarifies that all contracts entered into by a government entity must include a notice, that the requirement of the act apply, and that failure to include the notice does not invalidate the application of this subdivision. I believe this bill brings us back to or closer to the original legislative intent. We tried to craft the language so it does not expand or tighten the scope. I have an amendment that provides further clarification. With me today is Ms. Lori Beyer-Kopinski, Director of Community Services Division, Information Policy Analysis Division, also known as IPAD, from the Department of Administration, and Mr. Mark Anfinson, Attorney for the Newspaper Association. I will ask Ms. Beyer-Kopinski to discuss the bill and the amendment, and Mr. Anfinson will also say a few words about the case and the bill.
Okay. Ms. Beyer-Kopinski. I'm usually better. Kopinski. And the amendment's being passed up.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Lori Barkopensky, Director of Community Services for the Department of Administration. One of the areas I oversee is IPAD, which provides assistance to anyone who needs it in helping to understand what the Data Practices Act says and the open meeting law as well, so you can understand both your rights as a citizen and your obligations as government. So we answer those questions. And in response to a question that was raised by a testifier last week, it was about, does current law subject a contractor to all of the requirements of the Data Practices Act, which we've heard from a number of people. So it was a really good question. So we took it as the opportunity to figure out how do we craft an amendment that reflects the kind of advice that Commissioner of Administration Advisory Opinions and our office has been giving to the people who we serve. So this amendment seeks to do that. It would say that the data that the contractor has is going to be subject to both the protections that the classifications of data provide, as well as the public access pieces that the Data Practices Act also applies to data that's public. There's nothing in this provision that suddenly makes all of the data that contractors do public. There's nothing about that. It really just says that the Act and all of their features are going to apply to the data that is just subject to that contract. So when I buy a subscription to the Star Tribune for a newspaper service, you're going to be able to see that I pay $1.50 a week to get my newspaper. You're not going to be able to get to know how much Star Tribune pays for paper to put that newspaper together. So just to be able to clarify this. So hopefully that answers questions folks might have. And you all have the amendment. If there's any other questions, I can help hopefully answer them for you.
Somebody want to move the amendment?
I'll move the amendment.
Senator Johnson moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Welcome back, Mr. Anfinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. I'm gratified that you're happy to see me back so soon. I will be very brief. I litigated the case that has led to this bill last fall. Well, actually litigated over 2.5 years. It was a case that started when a small town newspaper editor in northern Minnesota used this law, this before you, to request a copy of a subcontract that the big corporation Johnson Controls had obtained while building new school facilities in the St. Louis County School District in northern Minnesota, obviously. And the school district did not have a copy of the subcontract. Only Johnson Controls, the general contractor, had this. The editor had been told by school board members that there were substantial cost overruns occurring with the project, $1 million, a lot for that contract. And so the editor said, does the contract between the general contractor and the architectural subcontractor contain indemnification provisions that might allow the taxpayers to recoup some of the cost overruns? And the school district said, we don't have a copy of the subcontract, so we don't know. The statute you have before you, 1305 sub 11, basically says that if a public agency does not have contract performance data for a government contract, you can go to the contractor and ask for the performance data. So the editor goes to Johnson Controls and says, may I have a copy of the subcontract with architectural resources? And 3 years later, we're standing before the Supreme Court. Well, what the Supreme Court held was contrary
to almost 15 years of settled law in Minnesota, 10 opinions of Ms. Byer-Kuprensky's agency, and two Court of Appeals decisions had said that even if the contract between the general contractor and the agency does not include a notice that this law applies, the law still applies to the data. The Supreme Court said, no, that's not what it says. If the notice isn't in the contract, if there's not a reference to this statute that the contract data are covered by the law, there is no application of this law. So in simplest terms, what this bill would do is restore state law to what everybody thought it was for 15 years, and everybody operated under the law interpreted that way with no visible difficulty. Now, one final point. I'll just, because this is in the wonderful jungle of abstraction that surrounds the Data Practices Act, let me give you a quick example of how this law operates in the real world. We can talk about big construction contracts. Let's say a school district has a contract with a private bus contractor, as many do. If this law didn't exist, two things would happen in that context potentially that are troubling. One, if I as a parent heard my child come home and say, I'm having some trouble with a school bus driver, and I wanted to find out who my child's school bus driver was, I would have no right to find that out if the school district didn't have the name. This law allows me to go to the school bus contractor and say, who is the driver for my child's route? That's all it does. The second part of the law is maybe much more important, and in fact is the bigger reason that legislature passed this law in 1999. Senator Don Betzold, by the way, was the chief author at the time. The bigger concern then was that an enormous amount of highly sensitive private data that government generates is now being transferred to private vendors through a variety of contracts. And you all know about that, much more now than in 1999. This law was intended to require those private vendors working with government to protect the privacy of this sensitive data. Again, under the Supreme Court's ruling, if those contracts now don't include the notice, that protection is gone as well. So in the school bus case, not only could I not find out the name of my child's school bus driver potentially, but the school bus company would not have to protect the privacy of student data in their possession. So again, the law worked pretty well for 15 years. Nobody had problems. But we all know the Supreme Court is smarter than the rest of us. So they ruled, and this bill simply tries to restore what the law was before. Thank you.
Any questions for Senator Dietzick or the witnesses? Anybody else in the audience that wants to testify on this bill? Then, Senator Hall, you're a co-author. Do you want to move the bill?
I'll move.
All right. Senator Hall moves that Senate File 1770 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
We were already at judiciary.
Oh, it's already been a judiciary.
Yes.
Did you move the amendment?
I think we might just.
Don't we want to go back?
I'll be there right tomorrow. So
let's restate the motion.
Friday,
does it go anywhere? Goes to the floor?
Just go to the floor.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hall.
Did you move the amendment already?
Did you move the amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Who moved it?
Senator Johnson.
Oh, Senator Johnson.
Yeah. Okay, Senator Hall then moves that Senate File 1770 is amended, be recommended to pass, sent to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks.
Madam Chair and
our
members.
First unsession bill.
This is an unsession bill, very much an unsession bill. So with me today, and I'm sorry, did you introduce yourself? John.
Madam Chair and members, John Eichten, Legislative Liaison for Minute Services. What you have before you today in Senate File 2310 are Minute's proposed unsession changes. These are designed to eliminate antiquated, unnecessary language and make conforming changes to the minute statutes in light of IT consolidation. It also eliminates some redundant powers that appear in minute statutes, and it clarifies minute's jurisdiction within the executive branch. I should point out the bill contains a repealer. You'll find at the end It strikes in order some references to outdated task forces that don't exist, some obsolete language requiring the Department of Administration to provide administrative support to Minute, language providing authority for joint actions that appears again verbatim in the statute. And the last piece, which is a section on the Advisory Committee for Technology Standards for Usability and Accessibility. This advisory committee did sunset in July of 2013. It is now part of the internal governance structure at Minute with the support of the disability advocates who were on that committee and continue to be on it, but it is no longer mandated in statute, and so makes sense just to take the language off the books. Answer any questions on the bill.
Any questions? Anybody else? I think we had someone else who wanted to testify, Mr. Heller. Mr. Heller, on this bill, the Minute Bill.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair, Ms. Pappas, and members of the Senate and Local Government Committee. I come here and speak unofficially for the Twice Exceptional and Print Disabled. As I speak here today, as the people see on the TV the closed captioning, I believe this is perhaps how the print disabled learn. They not only can see, but when they see a word and hear it, they make more understanding of it. You only find two types of these individuals in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008, there's blind and print disabled. The reason I come to speak on Statute 16E is about content accessibility based on 508 and 2.8 WCAG. Anyhow, I have a concern at the Capitol since 2009 that the documents weren't fully accessible. And to this day, it's my understanding that they are not. We all know that concerns.
Mr. Heller, I'm sorry, but that's not really the issue that's before the.
If you would permit, I could explain that because based in the appendix.
Oh, I see.
I could go to that immediately.
I'm sorry.
If you like.
I apologize. It is relevant. Okay, go ahead.
First of all, I use Adobe Reader that reads out loud for me. How I acquire and gather information is seen and heard. Once I got past that comprehension issue, I entered into application and understanding, and that's why I'm testifying today. I believe that the Appendix A under 1R to eliminate this committee would be a mistake because, again, currently the Capitol is inaccessible when regarding Dolby Reader, which now they're recommending. They're aware of this. I have two revisor letters.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Eichten.
Madam Chair and members, I might be able to speak somewhat to this issue. I do know Rick and I have discussed this before, and Rick, I'd be happy to talk to you about this afterwards as well. So it's clear the legislature is not included as part of IT consolidation. So if we are talking about some documents on the legislative website, Minute does not have jurisdiction over the Senate or the House, just to make that clear. But I know Rick's concern is that this committee would be going away, and I just want to make perfectly clear that the committee is not going away. It is part of the internal IT decision-making governance process, and the idea of housing it there was to bring it even closer to the decision-making, day-to-day decision-making around IT. So even though it's not in statute, it is continuing to operate with the leadership of our Chief Information Accessibility Officer, Jay Wyant, and we expect to continue to host this committee. And frankly, if it doesn't work out, the advocates have told us they'll come back to the legislature and get it put back into statute if possible.
Well, he can come back.
If I may speak on that.
Mr. Heller, briefly, I mean, the Minute is going to keep doing this committee.
Again, item 5 under duties only mentions blind. I can't say it enough. We need to include the print disabled as well in this discussion, and they have not been.
Absolutely,
Mr. Eichten.
And you'll find this at the American Published House of the Blind under and there's four types: blind, visually impaired, pre-readers, and non-readers. If we don't get a handle on this on a state level, including the rules, at the Capitol, haven't been revised since 2001 and 2 on the Senate and the House, and it's silent on accessibility, I think it would be appropriate to consider that with the LCC. Because if we can't wrap our hands around content accessibility, I really frankly don't know what all this paperwork is about. Because if we can't gain appropriate access for the blind and disabled, I don't know why we're up here talking.
Okay.
I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. Any other comments from anyone? Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair, and we did discuss this issue, and I think the final sentence, at least in my preparation, again saying that the committee is now part of Minute's internal governance structure, and I would agree that there's probably room for some improvement.
Okay, just move your bill.
And I would move Senate File 2310 be recommended to pass and go to the floor, I would expect.
Yeah. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Eaton.
Are you going to do yours next? Hi there. Senator Pappas.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. First of all, I'd like to move the A8 amendment, which is the author's amendment. And would someone bring me a copy of the A8? You're going to need it. You guys are going to need your own copies. Just bring me a copy of the A8. This makes some technical changes to the bill to put it in the shape I'd like it in.
Thank you. So you've moved the amendment. Are there any?
The A8 amendment, yeah.
The A8 amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment?
The author's amendment.
Oh. So we will vote on that? Okay. All those in favor of accepting the author's amendments, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Same sign.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The purpose of Senate File 1806 is to begin correcting the gender earnings gap in the Minnesota workforce. Minnesota women who are working full-time and year-round still earn only 80% of the earnings for their male counterparts, and the gap is even larger for women of color, rural women, and older women. Furthermore, the gap is not going away on its own. It's been stagnant for the last 10 years. Minnesotans have had pay equity laws on the books for 30 years now, and gender pay equity is now a reality for all state employees and for every city, county, and school district in the state. Now it's time to build on that success by extending pay equity to private businesses that wish to contract with the state. This bill builds on both the success with pay equity laws and the state's long practice of requiring these same businesses to submit affirmative action plans in order to bid on state contracts. The bill offers a process of ensuring that companies doing business with the state are paying women equally for work of equal value. The bill offers a phased-in process, keeps business data private. It applies only to contracts for goods and services over $500,000 and businesses with more than 40 employees in Minnesota. The basic requirement, which takes effect after the first year, is this. There's a provisional year. A business with more than 40 employees in Minnesota seeking a contract of more than $500,000 must have a pay equity plan certified by the Commissioner of Human Rights, much the same way as the Commissioner now approves the company's affirmative action plan. To obtain the certificate, the company must submit basic information about its pay equity plan to Human Rights. So this is a process, again, of ensuring that companies doing business with the state are paying women equally for work of equal value. So, Madam Chair, I have with me then Ms. Bonnie Watkins and Patty Tangi from the Pay Equity Coalition. and they're going to also make their statement, and then we can talk in more detail about the bill.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Eaton and committee members, my name is Patty Tangi, and I am a volunteer with the Pay Equity Coalition of Minnesota. We are a statewide organization of women's groups, unions, and individuals who care about fair wage-setting practices. We support Senate File 1806. More broadly, we support any measure to shift the gender wage gap. This bill replicates the steps we have taken in state and local government to eliminate the wage gap, and we now know paying employees according to the value of the job they perform and not paying them solely based on bias-ridden market-based salary surveys helps to eliminate that persistent gender gap. As advocates for women and their families who do not receive the full value of their work and their paychecks, we understand their burden, and that is the reason why we need this bill. But the business community talks about their burden and cost of implementing the pay equity program that this bill proposes. I would suggest putting an objective job and pay analysis system of fairness in place in return for a large amount of revenue subsidized by Minnesota taxpayer dollars is really good for business. Women and their families have been carrying the weight of this wage gap since we started measuring it decades ago. We know the gap is caused by many factors, one of which is job segregation, where women do women's work and men do men's work, and historically women's work is undervalued. And this bill shines a light on this outdated mode of paying women less than men for work of equal skill, responsibility, and effort. So thank you for hearing this bill today, and I thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Tangi. Does the committee have any questions for this testifier? I guess not. Ms. Watkins?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Bonnie Watkins. I am also a volunteer with the Pay Equity Coalition. I've been working on this issue for 30 years, since the time 30 years ago, almost to the day, when you all passed the Local Government Pay Equity Act, which now applies to every, as Senator Pappas said, every city, school district, county, and other public sector employer in the state. I also had the opportunity to write the administrative rule that governs that law, and I have worked with lots and lots of local governments, so it's been very interesting. And as Senator Pappas said, we just feel it is time to move forward, because successful though those laws have been, and they have been very successful, the fact of the matter is that 85% of the Minnesota workforce is in the private sector. So we really have not reached the vast majority of working women in this state. And that's why we still see that earnings gap. So I think others have done a good job of laying out what the job does. Just a couple of things to emphasize. One is, I don't want anybody to dismiss that 30 years of experience that this state has had with over 200,000 employees of public sectors. All 1,500 local governments are separate, autonomous employers, some with unions, some with not. I mean, they have all been through this process, and it has actually been very successful, both in terms of making sense from the employer's point of view and having the employees know they are fairly paid. Then I would just mention a couple facts. The law, we estimate the law would apply to about 1,000 large employers with contracts with the state. We don't have a perfect data set yet for who all it would apply to, but we're working on that. And then the standard for what is pay equity, I think, is really important, as it's stated here. Equitable compensation relationships means that the compensation for female-dominated classes is not consistently below the compensation for male-dominated classes of comparable work value. So you don't have to pay everybody the same, but you cannot just every single time a female-dominated job comes along pay less for that job, to make it short. And then just the how would a business do this? Very simply, there's two parts to the process if I'm a business that wants to review my workforce in this way. Number one, you need a job evaluation system. You need to somehow assess the jobs and decide on their relative value, usually with a point system, that can measure skill, effort, and responsibility in a pretty objective manner. And then you need to use that information to compare the pay. So one example of that is on the back of the handout that you have. It's a little chart brought some visuals for you all today. It says sample female-dominated and male-dominated jobs rated equally, in this case, in the job evaluation system used by the state, the Hay Associates system, which is a very well-respected system worldwide. Examples we gave here were registered nurse and computer programmer. Registered nurse is a female job, very often. Computer programmer, very often a male job. In our state system, those receive the same points for job responsibility. But look at the difference in the annual pay here in Minnesota. It's about $10,000 a year less that that nurse is receiving. There's another example there, but I hope that kind of gives you the picture. A couple other kind of visual things on that page I think really help. These are 30-year-old charts in the middle of that page from Minnesota state government before and after pay equity. Each little dot, looking at the chart on the left, each little dot is a male-dominated job class. And as you can see, as the pay, as the job evaluation points, the responsibility goes up, the pay also goes up. So that kind of makes sense intuitively to all of us. What happens when you plot the female-dominated jobs on that, which are represented by the letter F? Again, female jobs that are more responsible are paid more, but the pattern was so dramatic when we brought this to you all back 30 years ago. It was so consistent, it was so dramatic that the legislature just said, we need to fix this. So the after picture on the right-hand side there, again, not everybody with the same number of points is paid exactly the same. The state has 16 bargaining units. We still go through the bargaining process and everything else. But there is that scatter so that we don't always pay the women less. And that's exactly what this is about. Just two other things very quickly. The right below those charts is the information businesses would need to submit in the first year. And we purposely made that as simple as we possibly could. We really need information about, do businesses have job evaluation systems or not? So they need to say yes or no. Are they interested in training? Because there is a lot of information available through Minnesota Management and Budget that could be adapted to help them if they do want training. Total number of male and female employees, and that's really pretty much it for the first year. After that first year, it's still not a ton of information, but that is displayed on the bottom of that page. That's basically what is needed to determine whether they have achieved pay equity or not. So, Madam Chair, members, I hope that's a little bit of overview for this. Oh, there's also a frequently asked questions item that might answer some questions.
Thank you, Ms. Watkins. Does the committee have any questions for this testifier? Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, and when I was on the city council in 1984 in Spring Lake Park, that was one of the issues that I worked on, pay equity. And again, I remember these charts. But what I want to know right now is, do cities, when they get a contract or give a contract to someone, do they have to get a notice of compliance with pay equity before they can contract?
No, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, that's not included in this bill.
Nor is it current law. Current law only applies to their current employees. And we have really, Madam Chair, pretty much eliminated the wage gap between comparable jobs by men and women at city, county, Met Council, state level. So we have been successful in doing that. And one way that we keep on track is they do have to submit reports every 3 years so that you can catch if there's a pattern that's emerging before it gets too far down the line. But those are one-page reports that are pretty easy to submit.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Chair.
Oh, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, you probably said this, but I didn't hear, I guess. Who judges the equal value of the jobs, and who decides in that point system?
Senator Pappas.
Ms. Watkins will take that.
Ms. Watkins.
Chair, Senator Hall. Historically and legally, the job evaluation is a management prerogative. It's really top management that makes a final decision about what jobs are worth to their company internally. Thank you.
Okay.
Anything else?
All right. We have some more testifiers.
Next testifier is Ellen Ewald. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Ellen Ewald.
and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I'm here today as a citizen who believes strongly in the importance of ensuring gender equity. My life has been deeply impacted by pay inequity. I grew up in Hopkins, Minnetonka, Minnesota. I did my undergraduate work at the University of Minnesota and graduate work in Norway and at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I moved to Norway on a permanent basis in the 1990s, and I lived there for more than 20 years. In Norway, I had several positions, but for the last 13 years prior to my return to Minnesota in 2008, I was a business executive and worked with a variety of companies, many with ties to both Norway and the United States. I've always been interested in research, education, and business. When I was offered a job in Minnesota at the Honorary Norwegian Consulate, helping the Midwest and Norway interface in research and education, including business ventures, I was absolutely thrilled. I believe this was going to be my opportunity to really do something of value for the two countries I love so much. I was hired as an expert in higher education and research. I understood I would be working as part of a team, side by side with another employee who was an expert in business development and innovation. The postings with the job descriptions for the two expert positions were very similar. I was wooed to come back to Minnesota with the promise of a parallel and equal position with my teammate. When I was offered the job, I was told I would be paid the same as my male peer. Unfortunately, on the same day I got the job offer, my male peer was offered a job with a 42% more pay than me. It was clear this was meant to be kept a secret from me, but I ultimately discovered the truth. I learned that the other expert male employee was not only paid a significantly higher salary, but he received better benefits than I did. His spouse and children were covered by insurance, but mine were not. Having lived in Norway for a long time and appreciating the progressive and egalitarian nature of Norwegian society, I was sure that the consulate would rectify this unequal treatment. So I brought the pay and benefits disparity to the attention of the Royal Norwegian Embassy in Washington, D.C. Despite the strict prohibition against unequal pay, discrimination, and retaliation against women contained in Norway's own gender equity laws, embassy officials told me that's the way it is and that I should just accept it. I couldn't believe it, and frankly, I still don't. Instead of being helped, I was threatened repeatedly. At one point, now the Honorary Consul General told me there would be consequences and someone would likely have to go if I didn't stop complaining about unequal treatment. Nonetheless, I continued to raise my concerns throughout the embassy and with the leaders in Norway. I felt I had to, not only for myself, but for others working for the embassy. Sadly, my problem was never fixed by the embassy, and I had to resort to litigation. Pay inequities should be avoided or corrected immediately when discovered. No one should have to go through years of fighting to get fair treatment and incurring tons of attorney fees just to be treated the same. It's not fair that any woman has to fight so hard and so long for justice. I hope this law can help other women get fair treatment at the outset of their jobs. I won't give up. We all have to stand tall for this very important issue. Things do not change without a concerted effort. Feeling discredited, as I was, it's a terrible place to be. Starting out excited about your job and the difference you can make, and then being deflated by knowing someone who is supposed to be your peer is treated so much better than you are. And it feels even worse when in your gut you know that the unfairness is about your gender, something that you cannot change. I didn't fully understand what it felt like to be viewed as unworthy before this experience. It made me question myself in a way I'd never had before. I asked myself, what's wrong with me? What did I do to make this happen? These kinds of feelings impacted me not only in my life, my work life, but everywhere else as well. It's been tough to trust others in a work situation. Suffice to say, no one should have to go through something like I did. You here in the Senate can make a huge difference for women. This law is a great start to bringing other employers online with the state, with what the state does for its own employees. If there had been a law on the books that required my employer to report on how it was doing on pay equity, the embassy would have never been able to get by with paying two similar positions so differently. I understand the bill you're considering provides that a business must demonstrate it is in compliance with equitable compensation relationship standards or it is not certified. In my case, they could not have provided such proof. This type of law can ensure there is pay equity. I now firmly believe in this state or any place else will not be paid. I now firmly believe women in this state or any place else will not be paid fairly unless employers are closely watched to ensure there is fair payment, regardless of gender. We've been talking about pay equity since I was in college almost 30 years ago, yet women are at about the same rate of pay compared to men as they were that long ago. Please fight against this unfairness.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ewa. Is there any questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. The next person on the list I have is Melissa Raffin. Sorry if I massacred your name. From the Minnesota Employment Law Council.
Madam Chair, members, I am Jill Larson from the Minnesota Business Partnership. Ms. Raffin is in another committee testifying on another bill right now, so I apologize if we can switch the order.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members, again, Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Wanted to make a few comments about the proposal. And thanks, Senator Pappas, for meeting with us on this bill and listening to our concerns, and we hope to continue working with her on this proposal. I want to start out by saying that I represent about 110 of some of Minnesota's largest employers, and many of which would be impacted by this bill, but some of which would not because they don't contract with the state. But there are many, many other companies that will be impacted by this bill that aren't represented by me or anybody else that's going to testify in this. So I would ask you to keep that in mind as you're thinking through these issues. I also want to point out that this bill is not a pay equity bill. It is a comparable worth bill, and they are actually two very different things, despite the name of the bill. Comparable worth requirements are required, as was stated, for state and local governments in Minnesota. They are not required for private employers, and no other state that we're aware of requires comparable worth policies for any private employer for any state contract. So this would be something very new. The bill applies to anybody that has a contract of $500,000 or more. We asked the Department of Administration for a list of those vendors. There's about 1,200 vendors on the list that meet the $500,000 level contract. Nobody knows how many of those have 40 or more employees in Minnesota, so it could be a smaller universe, but it will be a lot of employers. And one of the provisions in the bill that concerns this is it only applies to employers that have 40 or more employees in Minnesota. And so my members who employ a lot of people here would have to sort of have this new mandate put on them, but their competitor who may be based in a different state that doesn't employ 40 or more people here will have a leg up to get the contract. So that's very concerning. I think I had a hand up, but Melissa's got it. So a couple of the other issues. There would be some really large compliance and administrative costs on employers if this were imposed. The way that our HR folks are looking at this is that it would force the private sector to essentially shoehorn into their current HR system or overlay it or possibly replace their current HR compensation systems with a system that was developed for the public sector. Now, our employers are already required to comply with federal pay equity laws, state pay equity laws, affirmative action plans that clearly say you must pay equal pay for equal work. So we're already required to do that under current law. This proposal references the comparable worth statutes and rules that are in place for local governments. Those would now apply to private businesses. I printed them out. There's some 40 pages of rules, new rules and regs that would now apply to private businesses that want to contract with the state. So it's not a study. I think it's kind of been portrayed as we just have to do a study. It's not a study. It's a new requirement that would be imposed on private employers. And the way that our HR folks are looking at this is that, you know, they do have job evaluation systems, but this proposal wouldn't allow, despite what some of the other testifiers have said, really wouldn't allow us to look at market forces, supply and demand. There may be a particular job. I think one of the examples used is that an emergency medical technician that scores the same number of points as the senior clerk or teller is paid more money. And in that particular case, there may be very good reasons that have nothing to do with gender discrimination why that particular job is paid more. There may be less people that want to be an emergency medical technician as opposed to a senior teller or a clerk. So there are some reasons that we need to allow the market to work to for our members to be competitive, because we're competing against companies all over the world that aren't going to be under this new requirement. I would just ask that you would take those concerns into consideration. I ask Senator Pappas to be willing to continue working with us on this. We completely support the underlying sentiment. It's just that this bill is drafted, and even with some of the new, even with the new delete everything, I mean, I don't want to get into all the details here, but we do have some questions. There's some new language in here that says you have to, no department can issue the contract unless the business has a certificate of pay equity compliance or the business has certified that it is exempt. I don't know. There's nothing in here that shows us how a business would be exempt. That's unclear to me. And there is some additional language on page 4 of the delete everything, line 4.6. It says that we have to submit information on the business's current status. I don't know what current status means. The business's interest in receiving training, who would provide this training? And then on lines 4.13 and 4.14, a plan for achieving compliance, including the business's proposed actions and response to the commissioner's recommendations. So it's not clear to me, would a business submit something and then the Department of Human Rights would look through it and send us back a bunch of recommendations, whatever those might be, and the company would then have to try to incorporate those. And all the while, this company is just wanting to bid on a vendor contract. So I know I've taken up a lot of time with the committee. I apologize, but I just wanted to sort of point out some of the – still a lot of questions that are unanswered with the delete everything. Thank you. I'd be happy to try to answer questions.
Are there any questions for Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair, I hope to continue working with Ms. Larson, too. You know, I mean, she brings up some good points that need to be clarified, or we need to, you know, have a discussion about that. And we will continue working with her now that we have the new draft. And I'm happy to get her feedback.
Is Ms. Raffin available? Beth Cadoon.
Madam Chair.
They're both testifying elsewhere.
Yeah, they're both in Jobs Committee. I apologize. I think I tried, we had to try to divide up the testimony before. I think I mainly hit all of the points. So in the interest of the time, I think we've said our piece. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, we're going to Judiciary from here, and then we're also going to Commerce. So we'll be able to, the committee would indulge me in keeping the bill moving, we'll be able to hopefully resolve some of these issues and clarify some of these issues in the next week or so.
Are there any other testifiers?
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Jill.
Any questions, committee? Seeing none.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate Bill 1806 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Judiciary Committee.
Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 1806 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
Motion prevails. Huh? Sit down. It's after you. I'm getting out of here.
You're on the seat, too.
Your hearing pills. Did you talk to your husband later?
Yeah.
I haven't had lunch yet.
He's going to win that the other times he can't hear me. I don't know if that's not good.
I don't want to incriminate your husband.
All right, David, you're up.
I just wanted to offer to help.
Yeah. Did you get 2,000 on 2490?
These are going to be tough.
It's special.
Senator Tomasoni, Senate File 2490.
Madam Chair, at the advice of counsel, we have an A2 amendment that would put the bill in the shape that we would like it to be in.
Okay, that amendment's being passed out. That A2 is an author's amendment. Someone like to offer it?
I'll offer it.
Senator Johnson?
I move.
And then he'll explain the amendment when he explains the bill. Then Senator Johnson moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, the best way for me to do this is to have Ms. Leverance explain the amendment and the bill. And this bill is regarding a joint powers agreement and the implications of what happens when two different unions are joined together as a result of a joint powers agreement by another entity. And it just kind of sets the ground rules as to how the workers have to be treated and should be treated in the event that the joint powers is trying to change some of the contract or until they agree to what the contract would be once the joint powers is entered into. So I'll let Ms. Leverance, go ahead and explain what the bill does and why we're here.
Ms. Leverance.
First, I would say about the amendment that was placed on the bill is this is a technical amendment. Near as I can tell, the reviser of statutes and the Senate counsel believe in drafting bills somewhat differently. And it was the riser who drafted the initial one. This one makes some corrections that Senate counsel wanted and that she and I met earlier today, and these are fine with us. They are simply technical changes, no substantive changes here.
Okay, why don't you just address then the substance of the bill?
Okay. This bill has, as its genesis, a situation the union I work for, Greater Minnesota AFSCME Council 65, got into in southwestern Minnesota in 2009. For a number of years, we had a union contract with a joint powers human services agency made up of Lincoln, Lyon, Murray, and Pipestone counties. We also had a public health entity made up of three of those counties that we had a union contract with. In 2009, the Human Services Agency and the Public Health Agency decided to merge, and Pipestone decided to have their public health be part of that new agency. For many months, our union tried to negotiate with the new new Joint Powers Authority about how that merger would go with respect to the union contracts. Then, in late 2009, Southwest Health and Human Services told the employees of the two agencies that Southwest Health and Human Services would be a new employer, and their union contract would no longer be honored. Their accrued vacation and sick leave would be eliminated. They would not be eligible for Family and Medical Leave Act leave because they wouldn't have worked long enough for the new employer. And each employee had to sign a document which said the union contract did not prevail, that the personnel policies of Southwest would prevail. One of our union activists refused to sign the document saying the personnel policies prevailed and was immediately fired. The employer also told two of our members who were pregnant and one member who was dying that they were not eligible for any type of leave.
my union and Southwest Health and Human Services, not surprisingly, ended up in court. That court fight cost my union $100,000 in attorney's fees and Southwest $150,000. Fortunately, we had a judge who was appalled by what happened and pushed Southwest and my union to come to an agreement to a new union contract. After the costly mess in southwestern Minnesota, during the 2011 session, AFSCME worked with Representative Jim Abler at his instigation to put language in his Health and Human Services finance bill to prevent this same sort of situation happening again in the new joint powers entities they were creating, service delivery authorities. Unfortunately, we now have counties that are considering not becoming SDAs, at least in part, because they don't want to have to follow the rules and statute that Abler got in his bill and got passed. So we are asking you to pass Senate File 2490, which is based on that language that went into Representative Abler's bill, and the language that's in the statute from when the state took over the court system, the county court system. Specific highlights of the bill include: it tells the State Bureau of Mediation Services how to decide what union, if any, will be representing the employees of a newly created joint powers authority. It's based on percentages of how many people or how many employees are currently covered at their member counties or covered by a at their member counties by a union contract. It would extend the term of the union contracts for 1 year after the new joint powers agency is formed to give the parties time to negotiate a new contract. It would require that employees retain their accrued leave and continue to be eligible for coverage under the Family and Medical Leave Act. It defines seniority as total time worked for the member of the Joint Powers Authority and the Joint Powers Authority, and make layoffs, recalls, wages, and benefits dependent on that seniority. It would prohibit outsourcing of the new agency's work. It would continue the employee's coverage in the group health policy from the county or city they came from. Let me be clear. AFSCME Council 65 is not opposed to joint powers authorities. We know there are times when they make perfect sense. An example I always use is some of those small counties in Minnesota probably don't do one adoption a year under the Indian Child Welfare Act. So there is no way for their social services department to develop the expertise to do that. But multiple counties working together do have the ability to develop that kind of expertise. My union also understands that there are times when joint powers authorities have employees who will provide duplicate services. We understand that may mean layoffs. That is why we have layoff language in the bill. But we do not think that the formation of a joint powers authority should be seen as a way for the employer to unilaterally get rid of a union and the wages and benefits that our members have fought so hard for. This bill does not mandate anything except the status quo until a new union contract is negotiated. The reason to oppose this bill is to be able to break the union and deprive the employees of the rights they had previously had. The last employer that tried this was Southwest Health and Human Services. And that fiasco cost the taxpayers $150,000 in lawyers' fees. I'm a lawyer myself,
but I don't believe that's a good use of taxpayer dollars.
Other testimony? Did you want to say something, sir?
Madam Chair, Steve Georgie, I'm the Associate Director with AFSCME Council 65. I think Sarah has basically laid out the provisions of the bill. The way I look at this and our council looks at it is we're looking for a transitional process for these hardworking public servants that are going to continue to provide the same exact services to their clients in the communities they live in, and without having their years of seniority, their improvements in pay and benefits taken away from them because of an administrative change at the very top. That just seems entirely wrong, and it's been a great sacrifice. It's a very stressful experience for the hardworking women that traditionally are providing these services in human service, public health departments where we see this most often occur. So, again, even in the private sector, if there's a change in ownership in the sale of a business, there are protections afforded in the federal law for at least 6 months to negotiate a new agreement. So we really think that these public servants deserve a fair opportunity, and the unions are willing to work through those transitional phases, but we just think we need a transitional period and some protections.
Okay, we have two more people who would like to testify. Why don't you come up together, Laura Kushner and Bo Berenson. Okay, welcome to the committee, Laura. Ms. Kushner, sorry.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Laura Kushner. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm their Human Resources Director. Prior to this job, I worked with Minnesota Cities for about 9 or 10 years. I think what I'm saying here is that this is a pretty complex bill. It's a pretty big change to how joint powers arrangements are put together for our cities and our counties. And we really haven't had a lot of time to digest it. We need to get some reaction from our member cities. We don't know yet what they would think. Here's what we believe so far. The bill takes away a lot of the incentive for cities and counties to merge their operations through joint powers arrangements. I don't know if any of you have ever been through any kind of a merger or any kind of bringing together of employers, but it's pretty complicated. There's different benefits. There's different policies. There's different pay structures. It's never an easy thing to do. And frankly, this bill, at least from first glance, we'd certainly be open to hearing more if we're interpreting it wrong. But at first glance, it sure looks like it's going to make it all the much harder for us to do that. In the last few years, as you all know, local governments have been encouraged to find efficiencies, to work with counties and school districts, to become more efficient. And this, for example, the Collaborative Governance Council in 2011 worked to identify impediments in collaboration in state structures or rules, state statute. And this bill just seems to go in the opposite direction. It seems to put more impediments in front of us. Also, in the last several years, provisions have been added to the Joint Powers Statute that do provide some of the protections that are in this bill. For example, a few years ago, the League worked with the Senator Thomasoni and I believe other senators from the Iron Range on making sure that if there's a layoff, you have to bargain over the effects and the impacts on those employees. And we didn't, we went with that language. Our cities are working with that language. Our counties are. And there's also language in there that we helped with on police mergers. So you have to receive credit for accrued sick and vacation leave if there's a merger in police departments. This law seems to duplicate that, and we haven't really even had a chance to settle into those new laws. We're still trying to get the word out to our cities about those laws, let alone something this big. Just very quickly, right now we have more questions than answers. The definition of entity in this bill isn't clear to us. It might be arrangements where a city is contracting with another unit of government, but there really isn't any separate entity being formed.
So we don't know how the word entity would be interpreted in that situation. And again, just more questions than answers at this point. We can say this much. It's a pretty big shift in how these arrangements are handled. And I think in fairness to the stakeholders who will have to implement this bill, we need more time to carefully consider all of its ramifications.
Any questions for Ms. Kushner? Mr. Berenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bo Berenson. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm here today to share some concerns our association has with Senate File 2490, which we fear will act as a roadblock to counties and cities seeking to work together through joint powers and other collaborative entities. Let me first say that this issue of working collaboratively is an extremely important one to Minnesota's counties. As the legislative auditor recently noted, because of the vast breadth of counties' work, counties rely on collaborative arrangements such as joint powers boards, joint agencies, or joint service districts far more frequently than other units of government. In fact, there are many areas of state statute where you, the legislature, has either mandated us to work as joint powers or else provided severe disincentive not to work as joint powers, specifically in the areas of public health, probation services. So certainly the message we've received from the legislature is collaborate, work together, form joint powers to work more efficiently and more effectively. And many of the cost savings that have been realized through joint powers have been used to increase services for citizens and provide more middle-class jobs, especially in rural Minnesota. The creation of these joint power agreements and entities all occur under PELRA, the state's Public Employment Labor Relations Act. PELRA does not only cover local governments, it also extends to new entities that are created when local governments come together to provide services jointly. And these joint powers entities around the state are significant employers, oftentimes of union labor. Our concern with this bill, and I want to address a couple provisions, and I do think Ms. Kushner raised some good issues for the committee to consider. I think there are some very technical issues that I want to make the committee aware of. One is the language in the bill, and I believe it's titled in the bill, prohibiting privatization. And I want the committee to understand how this intersects with the work of county government. Right now, it's a common model in areas like county human services, where an individual county agency or a joint powers agency doesn't necessarily have the technical staff under their employment to provide things like mental health services or chemical dependency services. So those, either the county or the joint powers, will contract with a private entity to perform those services simply because they don't have the talent, the specialized skill on their staff. The way I read this language, a group of counties who may be using that practice right now, and that practice is specifically authorized in statute, a county using those practices couldn't come together in a joint powers and continue to use that practice. That, of course, is a disincentive to local governments to collaborate on issues like that. Another example of where this bill provides more challenges for a joint powers entity than is currently than the current separate entities are subject to is the requirement for joint powers to both A, train and retrain existing employees for a changing work environment, and also B, provide assistance to employees in finding suitable employment anytime there is a loss of position and employment within the joint powers. This put local governments in the position of duplicating services already available through deed, and the vague language in the bill we fear would be a ripe area for potential lawsuits to employers and obviously taxpayers. We think that these provisions, again, aren't applicable to individual counties, individual cities. They'd only then become applicable if they started working collaboratively in a joint powers. Again, a disincentive for cities and counties to work together. One last point I'd make is that, you know, I think this bill goes to great lengths to ensure that employees' pay and benefits are protected when they go from a single employer to a joint entity. But something for the committee to consider is, should that also then apply to other items in an employee's file, such as disciplinary actions that they've been subject to under their employer if they move to a joint powers? Do things like disciplinary actions, other pieces of their employee file follow them as they head to the next entity? You know, the last point I'll make is, you know, we don't want to see something put in statute where if local governments start to consider the idea of working collaboratively, work more efficiently, that they're going to open up the statute book, see a list of requirements, and decide it's not worth it. I think the message we receive from the legislature is do it faster, do it more efficiently, work together, work collaboratively, and we just don't want to see something in statute that's going to stand in the way. My last point, and I know I already said it was my last point, is a lot of this bill was referenced to, a lot of the previous testimony was referenced to Southwest Health and Human Services. Quite honestly, I was not an employee of AMC at the time that situation happened, and I hesitate to speak too much about it simply because I did not live through it. I do want to make available to the committee, this is a letter from 2012 that county boards through the Southwest Health and Human Services organization sent to Governor Dayton related to the claims AFSCME was making. I simply present this in that there is some disagreement on what happened to employees in that transition that does differ from the previous testimony. So if the committee would like to review the letter, I'd pass it. I'm sorry.
Any questions for the witnesses? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Berenson, you mentioned privatization. Give me an idea or approximation of how many counties in your short time of working with the League of Minnesota Cities or the, MP. I should say, the counties are in that situation where maybe you don't have that
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator. I can't give you a good number. I'm happy to ask our again, this the situations I was talking about really relate into our health and human services area, and I'm happy to talk to some of our health and human services staff and help provide that information.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kushner, could you give me any idea of how many people are, or maybe just not privatization, are there other areas that, you know, this bill would impact counties, joint powers, or things like that that would have this would have a negative effect on the counties being able to interact with other counties or to incur other services that, you know, I don't know. I'm just saying.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Kushner.
Thank you. Senator, I'm, as I said, I just started reading this bill yesterday, so there's a lot to think about. But I've certainly worked in a lot of cities where for example, years ago when I worked for the city of Roseville, we had a contract with the city of Lauderdale, and we provided a lot of administrative assistance to them because they weren't big enough to have their own administrator. We, you know, there are lots and lots of contractual situations between cities, between counties. I can think of a city in greater Minnesota where they contract with the school district to provide certain kinds of programs in their recreation department. So there is a lot. In fact, we have a large database on our website, I'm sure, that talks about all the different collaborative efforts that are going on. I'm sure we could get you as much data as you wanted.
Thank you.
Senator Tomasoni, this session is moving very fast. Do you, and this bill doesn't go anywhere else but the floor. Do you want more time to talk to the counties and the cities and work out some of these lack of clarification? Do you want to talk to them and make amendments on the floor?
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
I don't think there's any intent here to make joint powers be
more difficult to make.
And the obvious reason for the bill is so that in the event of a forming of a joint powers and two union contracts, that that the workers are protected until such time that another contract is negotiated. And so that's the intent of the bill. And if that's not right, then my AFSCME friends should come up and so I'm not sure we're seeing all these things that the League of Cities and the counties are saying they are, how many more meetings do you have?
We have a number of more meetings. I don't know where this is at in the other body, but we are meeting Monday afternoon, Monday evening, Wednesday afternoon, Wednesday evening, and probably Friday. So if you want some more time to work some of these things out, and then you can come back and we can just revisit it briefly, that would be, I'm willing, perfectly willing to do that, rather than have people unhappy and have a big floor fight.
Yeah, I'm hearing their concerns, and I know what we're trying to do here, and mm-hmm. So it doesn't seem to me that we're trying to do what the concerns are.
Right.
And it seems to me what we're trying to do is just to make sure that workers are protected in the event of a joint powers as performed, and nobody's suggesting that it be more difficult to form a joint powers than it already is. It's all about making sure that the joint powers doesn't unilaterally take over the employees' contracts
right. After
they've been working for AFSCME for 20 years and suddenly they have no rights or no accrual of their benefits or seniority. So,
so Senator Thompson, I mean, you have my commitment that we'll bring it back as soon as you're ready.
Do you guys want to do that? All right. Then, Madam Chair, then that's acceptable, and I would hope that we can all work together and figure out a way to get this done right. Okay.
All right. So Senate Bill 2490 is temporarily laid over. Then our last bill on our agenda is, I see a question here. Oh, is two bills that are very similar, Senate File 2275 and Senate File 2179. And I don't know if you want to take these together, you want to work together or separately, or Senator Westrum and Senator Schmidt, how do you want to do this?
Sure, yeah, that's fine.
All right.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, thanks for making some time for us tonight. We have some great testimony on tap for you. And, we have a number of folks who have been waiting patiently here from southeastern Minnesota and elsewhere to talk about traffic safety diversion programs that have been incredibly popular in Goodhue and Wabasha counties and other areas in Minnesota. And in taking a step back, what these programs try to do is give local law enforcement a third choice between simply writing a citation or giving an oral or written warning. And that third choice is an invitation to a traffic safety diversion program, an educational class that offers offenders of minor traffic violations an opportunity to receive educational, you know, curricula by trained professionals and essentially give them an opportunity to learn and become better drivers. And what we've seen over the last 10 years is we've seen a lot of, well, there's a whole story here, but we've seen more fees attached to citations issued by local law enforcement and those fees coming back to the state. And it's been very difficult for local law enforcement as they have to make that decision between issuing a full citation with an increasingly large fee attached to that, a surcharge attached to that, or simply giving yet another warning. And that's why these traffic safety diversion classes have been very popular as a third choice. And it's also a choice for the drivers who have been pulled over for minor traffic offenses to get back into the classroom, learn about the changes in traffic law. And for a lot of folks, this is the first time for them to learn about what's changing in traffic law since they perhaps went through driver's ed in high school. And so we have a whole bunch of great stories from local law enforcement, from local elected officials, and also from folks who've participated in these programs at the local level. Why we're here today before you is it's pretty clear that these programs, it's not fully authorized, and that there's a question as to whether or not state statute perfectly spells out how these programs are to proceed under law. And so we wanted to respond to a report the state auditor put together and a local court decision and make it perfectly clear that these programs are authorized and that they meet a certain educational standard that we're asking the Department of Public Safety to work with stakeholders to establish. We also settle another question as to whether or not a surcharge collected and sent to the state applies to these programs. In this bill, we say it does not. We also cap the level that of a fee, if you will, that can be charged for participants in these programs at $75 and specify that all revenue raised from these fees need to be directed towards traffic safety at the local level. That you, in essence, you can't be buying, you know, police cars or cross-subsidizing other aspects of your budget. At the local level, all revenue collected from these programs needs to be directed towards traffic safety. And the whole emphasis here is on improving safety on our roads, further educating our drivers, and giving our local law enforcement another choice in how they deal with minor traffic safety violations. And I should mention, it's a choice not only enjoyed by local law enforcement, but also by those pulled over. They don't have to. They don't have to join the class. They can simply pay a citation instead. So I kind of gave you the general rundown there. It's a pretty straightforward bill, and I'd be happy to walk through it section by section if you'd like, but that really touches all the bases in terms of what we're trying to accomplish with Senate File 2275.
Senator Schmidt, I understand you have an amendment.
That is true. Yes, I have. I think the A3 amendment.
That.
And it's mostly technical changes that I had worked on.
Okay. Why don't we have that amendment passed out? And then, Senator Westrum, would you like to make some opening comments?
Madam Chair, I will, and when I'm concluded, I just was in committee and I had emailed my LA, and I don't know if staff made an amendment for my bill or not. I don't know that they were able to, so if they are, they can let me know. I'm just here up here from Transportation Committee, so I'm a little out of the loop. But Madam Chair,
could you just talk about the issue?
I'll talk about the issue, and real briefly, Senator Schmidt and my bill have the same impetus and the same goal in mind. There's a few differences, but ultimately, it's an authorization for the local units of government through statute to clarify the court decision and the questions that he talked about, and so I won't repeat all that. His bill and my bill are quite similar, and ultimately we would ask you to consider passing both of those bills, and we view by the next stop we will probably have our bills together and taking pieces out of my bill and putting into his that we feel are better. But his bill has several pieces that my bill at this point doesn't, and so that's why we think we will continue to work them together and come up with one bill by the next committee stop and ultimately for its last visit to Transportation Finance before the floor. And so we have a county that does the similar type program. Grant County is my local home county, and this is just a good option to offer. I will reemphasize, the officers still give the person that they're pulled over the citation. This is an option. And if they're from Montana, they don't have to come back for the course. If they're from the hometown, they don't have to take the course. But if they're offered this option, a diversion class, then they can take that, and then the ticket would go away and not be affecting their insurance records, but they would be required to go through the course and learn and have some refreshers and updates. And so it's an option that they can choose if they're offered the diversion ticket instead of the original fine or penalty. But they do have the citation, and so they can say they can pay that and proceed just like normal. And so I want to make that clarification for committee members. And I'll leave the rest for testimony and questions.
So why don't we take the A3 amendment on 2275. This is not your first stop, right? So we could have staff explain the amendment, or would you like to, Senator Schmidt?
You know, I can quickly run through this. It's very technical, and essentially what we're doing is we're defining a local unit of government, as it's referred to in the bill, also defining what a diversion program is meant, and just simplifying the references thereto. Simply as the program. So you see much of the amendment is just cleaning up that kind of redundant reference language. And I have to tell you, I think that is the thrust of this amendment here. I would defer to staff if there's anything I missed there, but I believe it's technical in nature and just cleaning up the presence of the bill.
Do you want to add anything, Ms. Stengel?
Madam Chair, Senator Schmidt, the only other thing I would add is we are deleting lines 8 to 10, and that's cleaning up some of the language about preemption.
Sure.
So I think that's largely technical as well. I just wanted to make sure that was noted.
Thank you.
Senator Hall?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any opposition to this?
I don't know. We'll ask in a minute, but why don't we go ahead and adopt this amendment?
Oh, sure.
Someone want to offer the amendment?
So moved.
Senator Wicklund? Okay. Senator Wicklund moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. We have three individuals from Wabasha County.
Madam Chair, if I could, we had a great contingent show up today to testify, and I don't think we need to hear testimony from everybody.
Okay.
But perhaps if we could just have the sheriffs from Goodhue and Wabasha County just outline their programs real quickly.
Okay.
And then hear from some local elected officials, if that
right.
would be okay.
That's fine.
Sheriffs, if you wouldn't mind.
A lot of brass up there.
And Madam Chair and committees, I'm not in trouble here sitting between these two. So.
Why don't we bring up another chair? Could the page help us for Senator Westrom? And he can just sit up in the at the table too. Senator Westrom, if you want to come back up here. Just brought another chair for you.
Mm-hmm.
To your left.
Madam Chair, Sheriff Rodney Bartsch from Wabasha County. Senators, good evening. We're here in support of these two bills. Wabasha County has been running this program for a little over 10 years. We've ran quite a few violators through the program. Through the years, we've been cited by different organizations for that we shouldn't be doing what we're doing. We did it with the authority of our county attorney's office, and we felt we were doing the right thing. After each class, I'd read the evaluations from the people that were in attendance, and that's what kept us going. This is truly a citizens program, your constituents programs, if you have them in your respective counties. But they said, you know what, I learned something. I came in here with a bad attitude, and I walked out with a great attitude. It was a face-to-face contact, educational learning that they took in, and it just kept us going because we said, as long as there's value here, and so there's a money side of this, and the money side that everyone should know is that counties, unlike cities and towns, don't take in a dime from these citations, none of them. It was a statute, I think, in 03 or 04 that was enacted that talks about two-thirds of the base fine goes to cities and towns, and counties were left out of that statute, whether it was on purpose or if it was an error. But so I really have to consider when I buy a radar unit for one of my squad cars, what am I doing, and who am I funding? And I know this is about public safety, but yet we have to consider the constituents that are paying for the wheels and the gas and the radar units as well. So so there was a dual component for why we were running our program, and obviously some of you know that we were shut down. Others still continue today because they see the relevance or the value of the program they're doing. So thank you for allowing us to be here.
Thank you. That was Mr. Bartsch, right?
Yes.
And welcome. Please introduce yourself at the tape.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sheriff Scott McNerland with Goodhue County. We've been running a diversion program, traffic diversion program, since 2008. We've had approximately 4,300 drivers attend our program. And like Sheriff Bartsch, we pay very close attention to the evaluations at the end of the program. And what we heard overwhelmingly is positive feedback. Drivers were appreciative of the opportunity to learn. I think Senator Schmidt hit the nail on the head. Many of us don't receive any driving instruction after we get out of driving school and get our license. And I think it's a very important aspect of what we do is education as well. We kind of looked at this program inside and out. We really see the value. We listened to our constituents who want to see this continue. We've had conversations with our county board members, two of which are here today to also speak to this issue, who would also like to see this legislation move forward so we can continue these programs. I think there's great value in them. I think that people are actually learning something. I think a lot of our attendees originally thought that they were coming to this with the opportunity to perhaps have a ticket dismissed, but the feedback has been that they actually learned something and they found value in it. To the point where we had attendees actually ask us if their children or siblings could attend our next session because they thought it that highly of the program, and we've allowed that to happen. So from our perspective, these things are very important, and I believe they should continue.
Senator, question from Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, sheriffs, for coming up here, over here, down here. I think you said southeast Minnesota, so up here. Just trying to figure out the mechanics here of the way this works. And the first gentleman from Wabasha County had mentioned the financial end of this. So as I understand it, the citation fees are being collected in part by the state, in part by the cities, and in part by what was the other entity that you had mentioned?
Towns and cities.
And then so the counties are not
Peterson.
Collecting, Madam Chair, thank you, collecting fees. And that is one of the reasons why the diversion program, and of course, obviously, public safety is the first and foremost. But the other is obviously the cost component or the fee generation that is derived of these diversion programs. Am I correct in that assumption?
Sheriff Bartsch.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's correct. In 2003, shortly after I was elected, surcharge raised in the state again, and we said, what's going on here? And we started looking at the dynamics, and it was, I think the surcharge may be up to $85 now, but the base.
I think it's 75.
75 right now? Here. Okay. Yeah. The base on most of them then is 40 to 50, somewhere in there, and then the cities and towns collecting two-thirds of that. But so there's not a lot in there anyway. The rest, most of it comes up here. So that was some of the...
Santa Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Sheriff. I read this bill before we came in, and I'm a little bit torn on it. I don't like some of the incentives that are created almost for county sheriffs to actually maybe over-pursue some of these violations in the financial interest of their counties. Of course, you know, again, public safety is always first and foremost, and I understand and appreciate that. But, you know, we all have financial realities as well. One of the pieces of this bill that I'm a bit concerned about, given the dynamic of how these fees are collected and who is financially benefiting from them, I direct you to line 4.16 of the bill, which is the Subdivision 6 Officers Authority section. The authority to refer a person to an educational diversion program under this section is reserved exclusively to the licensed peace officer. So the situation that I'm really concerned with here is you've got this cross-jurisdictional situation where I could be, for example, in a city where the city police are going to pull me over. Obviously, we've granted them the ability to not offer the diversion program. The city may be well within your county. The city is going to have this, what I think is a perversion of the right sort of thought process that should be going on in this situation. The city is going to have no incentive to offer the diversion program because they already collect fees from the citation in the first place. So in Anoka County, I actually live on the border of Andover and Coon Rapids, and as you probably know, Andover is served by the county sheriff. Coon Rapids is served by the city police department. And what I'm worried about, and what I'd like you to maybe speak to, and maybe if my assessment is correct, is this strange, perverse incentive of these jurisdictions that cross over one another where I almost have to hope that I get pulled over by a sheriff, maybe, because sheriff is going to offer this program. I don't like the inherent authority piece of this bill, I guess is what I'm getting at. And if this is an option, it ought to be an option for everybody. And I don't like that the officer at the point of this has that ability to make the distinction. If we're going to go ahead and do this and we believe this is worthwhile, then the entire counties that opt in, everybody that gets pulled over, with the exception of the repeat offender, and I appreciate that element of it, should be made available. So if you could speak to that,
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, I appreciate that question and the thoughtfulness you bring to this discussion. I think, first of all, it's important to recognize that it's not simply counties or sheriff's departments that are participating. We have a number of police officers, police chiefs who are engaged in this as well. I know in Wabasha County, we have the not only Wabasha County, but also the city of Wabasha and the city of Plainview participating. So it's not simply the sheriffs who would be pulling over, you know, those with minor traffic safety violations and making that decision on the spot. Likewise, in Goodhue County, Red Wing, the city of Red Wing participates in partnership with the county. And that story is replicated throughout the state. And I think when you get down to the question of authority, the officer, whether it's a sheriff, you know, deputy, or if it's a police officer pulling over somebody for a minor traffic safety violation, on the spot there, they already have authority. They can issue a written warning, an oral warning. They can have a full citation. They have discretion in terms of what they clock you at, and, you know, if you're speeding. There's a lot of discretion that already lies in that officer who's pulling over a driver. And in my mind, and I think you're going to hear support here, that these traffic safety diversion programs doesn't really change that dynamic. We really rely upon our officers, you know, to make these sorts of decisions on a regular basis.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator. I totally appreciate the fact that officers have the authority already to sort of make those distinctions. What I'd like to believe is that those distinctions are based upon their perception of what serves the best interest, the best public safety interests of their communities. What this does, and maybe not intentionally, but what it does is enter in another factor into the that decision-making process, so that maybe the interest, the public safety interest, at times, depending on the county's situation, may not be the only consideration. And that's what I'm worried about. I understand that the authority already exists, but what this does is create, in particular for county sheriffs, and maybe in cities, because I'm sure not every city within counties participates in the manner in which you describe, creates an incentive that I don't think is centered around the best interest of public safety, or at least leaves the door open for that decision. And I would appreciate if the officers, if the diversion of program is adopted by a county, that everybody in the county is availed that option. And that way you eliminate that problem. And the officer can choose not to cite someone in general, but I guess I don't like the way that interacts and the incentives that are sort of created by that. And I'd like to know what your thoughts are on eliminating that. And I'm sure you've worked on the language. I'm not going to offer an amendment here, but you can see where my train of thought is going.
Yeah, and Madam Chair and Senator, I really appreciate this dialogue. I would say that we have at least two stops ahead of us on this, and we're in constant conversation about improving this bill and merging these two, perhaps. I think as it comes down to your question, your concern, I go back to that discretion that we already entrust our officers with, and I mean, they are making decisions on a regular basis as to whether or not to issue a written warning versus a full citation. And essentially, and I get your question about the incentives that are inlaid here, but what we're adding here is a third choice. If there's a driver, for whatever reason, an officer feels could benefit from additional education and in that middle approach, that's what these programs authorize, that third choice. And I'm happy to address the concerns you raise. I mean, I think that there's a lot of conversation that can ensue after this committee hearing around that question. And we, I'm optimistic that if we came, in front of the next committee, that we might have a resolution on that question.
Senator Peterson.
One last comment then. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to members of the committee for indulging me here a little bit. I'm sure that the cities and the city police departments insisted upon this language or would insist upon this language. Has that interaction taken place, and is this something that the city police departments and town police departments, in fact, have insisted upon in order for this bill to sort of bring, pardon the cliche, a peace in the valley?
Sure.
Senator Schmidt.
Chair and Senator Peterson, we've tried to have a full kind of dialogue with a number of stakeholders, sheriffs, police, county attorneys, trying to be in regular contact with the Department of Public Safety and others. And I have to tell you, nobody's making any demands necessarily. I think what I'm hearing from our local law enforcement agencies is clear authority and in a clear path forward for these programs to exist. You heard it from the sheriffs here. You'll hear it from other testifiers today. There's a tremendous amount of feedback that we're receiving that these programs are really valuable, that they're great educational opportunities, that it's a great choice for not only our local units of government, but for our law enforcement agencies and drivers who are put in the position of making that choice. And I think that's the driving incentive here. I think much of the detail around this can be worked out. And if there's any concerns among members of the committee here that you would like us to address between stops, if we have that opportunity, I'd be happy to take that to those discussions and hear from stakeholders. But to your point, again, nobody's making any demands. We have to have X, Y, or Z. I think we just want clear authority and a path forward for these programs.
Is there anyone here that wants to testify against this bill? That question came up earlier.
And otherwise, Madam Chair, I'm not sure if you or the committee would be interested in hearing from some local elected officials. Otherwise, I think, if folks are comfortable with where we're driving with these bills. Mm-hmm.
I think we kind of get the point. Senator Scalzi.
Sure. Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I do have a question because I was here when we passed this bill originally. And so I just have a question about where the money goes, because I heard some testimony about the sheriff departments have needs for equipment and whatnot. So then would the money, instead of going to the city, would now go to the county sheriff and it would bypass the city? Is that what's happening?
Right now, it's not clear where the money goes. And so one of the issues that we wanted to address in this legislation was make it clear what a local unit or an agency can charge for admission to the program, and then make it crystal clear that all revenues raised have to go towards the administration of that driver safety program and other similar educational programs. So the money has to stay at the local level, has to stay at the jurisdiction that is engaging the driver, and has to be focused on educational programming.
So the financial impact would be with part of the fee that usually goes to the state.
Well, and that's a question. We do have a fiscal note coming with this bill, and we're expecting that's going to be a topic of discussion when we get in front of Transportation Finance. Public Safety Finance, which would likely be our last stop. And that's a conversation that we're prepared to have.
Senator Scalzi.
Actually, Ms. Chair, my question was the amount of money that's currently going to cities versus the county sheriff department, that it's now going into the city budget, and then they would lose, for the administrative fines, they would lose that revenue, and then that revenue instead would go to the law enforcement authority that would be conducting the classes. So it would be a transfer of the money.
You know, Madam Chair and Senator Scalzi, I'm no expert in this area necessarily, but my understanding is that we may be conflating a couple of different programs out there, and we have administrative citations that arose in the last decade, and that splits the $60 fee three different ways. And in this case, we have a surcharge. 100% of that $75 surcharge, to my knowledge, comes back to the state. And so that's the question. I don't think there's going to be any local budgetary, cross subsidies or any impacts like that. I think the simple matter is if we authorize these programs to continue, we want to have the fee set at an appropriate level so that it's economic for these local units to administer these programs, but that they're not charging so much that they're cross subsidizing other programs or buying squad cars or anything like that. We want to clearly authorize a fee at a level that pays for the educational experience in the program.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, to either the testifiers, is there a notation other than Wabasha County that there has been a diversion of this money used for things that it was not designed for? I mean, I remember reading this story about Wabasha County, but in talking to my county sheriff, who's here today, and talking to my county attorney, everything that they collected as far as similar type of scenario that they do is all put back into maintaining and providing education and making this thing work. Are there notations, Senator Schmidt, or to the testifiers of other counties that there's money that's being siphoned off to other other things other than what it should be from what your bill is saying?
Madam Chair, I have to tell you that that's a concern that we want to address here. We don't know. I mean, I think right now under current law that could happen. And so if we were to fully authorize these programs to move forward, we want to be crystal clear, what the educational component's going to look like, what fee can be assessed, and what that the revenues derived from that fee would be used for, and specifically educational programming at that local level tied to these driver safety programs. And Senator, I'm sorry, I might have missed part of your question. I'm sorry if I'm not addressing it.
Madam Chair, Senator Schmidt, I was just wondering, because I've spoken with my local sheriff and county attorney, their money is basically used within the context of the program that was designed back 2003 or whenever it was and hasn't diverted. I'm wondering, and you said you didn't know if other counties have, except for the story that I read in the Star Tribune about the diversion of funds. So I'm just wondering if there are other counties that are using the program and there's something in the background that has risen to the top saying, oh, there's problems out there, and we're trying to get to the bottom of it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Madam Chair, just to that specific question, I am aware that in my local case, there is some of the money that's used for one-time improvements to technology or that would relate to the enforcement of the law. In my bill, permits that, and it wouldn't, I don't know that they think or know they're doing anything wrong, then, or there is anything wrong with it. Senator Schmidt's language does tighten it up or clarify that this is what the money would be used for. And so I think that's all part of what's going on with clarifying and what practice do we want going on if this diversion ticket is used. And so I can be persuaded either way, and if people are more comfortable with some being used for improvements, one-time improvements in the department for enforcing the law, that seems to make reasonable sense as well, or all of it directed to the program or a hybrid. Senator Schmidt's bill specifically goes to the program. My bill has kind of a hybrid approach.
So the intention of the authors, the hours late, is that we move both these bills to the Judiciary Committee, and they have several more stops to make before they kind of finalize this. I imagine it might end up in an omnibus bill,